if you don't listen to talk radio, if you don't watch the Fox News Channel, you're not anywhere nearly as informed as people that are just hearing the bumper stickers, the slogans, the snippets, the commercials of the media.
This Week in Radical History, for the week starting December 8th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer. Some radical info can be found at the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. And an audio segment is borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
On December 8th, 1980, John Lennon is gunned down outside his apartment in New York.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. Sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no country. It isn't hard.
December 8th, in 1982, American anti-nuclear weapons activist Norman Mayer was killed by the United States Park Police after he threatened to blow up the Washington Monument. Mayer had driven a white van, which he claimed was full of dynamite, to the base of the Washington Monument. He threatened to detonate it unless the U.S. agreed to seriously engage in a national dialogue on the threat of nuclear weapons. As Mayer moved back towards his van, the police opened fire on him, killing him. It was later discovered that he did not, in fact, have any explosive materials. The park police claimed that they did not intend to shoot Mayer, but were rather aiming at the van's engine. Mayer was shot 4 times, twice in the head. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you to never let the past slip away.
This Week in Radical History for December 9th, proving once again that this country was not founded on religious freedoms, like in the New World in 1640, when settler Hugh Bewitt is banished from the colonies for declaring himself to be free of original sin. Also on December 9th, 1842, the anarchist prince, the prince who became a revolutionary, the prince who shunned material wealth, Prince Peter Kropotkin, is born in Moscow. Though he grew up in privilege, he rejected it. Writer of many books, perhaps most famous is his 1902 published Mutual Aid, A Factor of Evolution, which provided an alternative view to animal and human survival. Here's a one-minute documentary segment on Kropotkin and the Russian anarchist revolution.
The Russian Revolution of 1917 was a spontaneous uprising of peasants and workers. All across Russia, workers organized factory committees, called Soviets, and popular assemblies in the villages.
Then the Bolsheviks, headed by Lenin, swiftly and ruthlessly imposed one-party rule. They claimed that the success of the revolution depended upon the people's obedience to the single rule of the leaders. The Cheka, the secret police, suppressed all non-Bolshevik factions, including the Russian anarchists. The great anarchist theoretician, Peter Kropotkin, returned from exile hoping to see his ideas of mutual aid put into practice. He died in 1921, disillusioned with the course of the revolution. Ironically, many imprisoned anarchists were permitted to attend his funeral, but it was the death knell for anarchism in Russia, and those lucky enough to escape, like Emma Goldman and Molly Steimer, reluctantly turned their backs on the country of their birth.
Years earlier, Michael Bakunin, one of anarchism's leading proponents, warned that the Marxists, instead of abolishing state power, would simply transfer it from one group to another. His words turned out to be prophetic. He said Marx and his friends will concentrate all the powers of government in strong hands. The red bureaucracy will be the most violent, terrible lie our century has created.
More anarchist news, this time French news. In 1893, Auguste Vallant will throw a small bomb into the Chamber of Deputies, a symbolic gesture meant to wound rather than kill. Vallant is condemned to death and guillotined, and deputies would use this event to suppress the anarchists. Vallant explained why he, an anarchist who strove for a society of peace, resorted to acts of violence. Quote, "I have seen capital come, like a vampire, to suck the last drop of blood out of the unfortunate outcasts. When I came back to France, it was apparent to me where it was reserved for me to see my family suffer in the most terrible manner. This was the last drop in the cup of my sorrow. I tired of leading a life of suffering and cowardice. I carried this bomb to those who are primarily responsible for all society's miseries." Unquote. Also on December 9, 1953, General Electric announces all communist employees will be fired and fights union organizations. Representative John Ratkin of Mississippi uses his seat on the House Un-American Activities Committee to argue that blacks had been happy with segregation until stirred up by the communist agitators. General Electric President Charles Wilson said, quote, "The problem of the U.S. can be summed up in two words, Russia abroad, labor at home." That's definitely more than two words, but who's counting? Last Santa State in 1981, black Philadelphia journalist and activist Mumia Abu-Jamal is arrested and charged with the killing of a Philadelphia policeman. Evidence would disappear, witnesses would be intimidated by police, police officers change their testimony to fit the official line, and the prosecutor would eventually be the judge considering Mamoul's appeal at his death sentence. And justice for all. Only got two items for December 10th, 1961. Clouds of radioactive steam escaped underground nuclear test site, closing several New Mexico highways. And this contamination will happen again 5 years later. Also on this date in 1980, radio commentator Paul Harvey scoffs at renewed calls for gun control in the wake of John Lennon's murder. Quote, "Well, now wait a minute," he says. "Death has claimed a lot of rock musicians prematurely, and none with guns. Keith Moon, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, OD'd on drugs, and Elvis Presley and Brian Jones and John Bonham. Plane crashes killed Jim Croce and Otis Redding and Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, Ronnie Van Zant. In fact, Lennon at 40 lived much longer than most of those." Unquote. So it turns out that Lennon was really kind of lucky with repeatedly being shot in the back.
Now you know the rest of the story.
This Week in Radical History for December 11th, 1950, Bertrand Russell recommends that all warmongers spend time in a boat with shark-infested pool. He humbly suggests that they forget the part about the boat. 5 years later, he would co-write the Russell-Einstein Manifesto, along with Albert Einstein and nine other intellectuals of their day, calling for nuclear disarmament. Also on December 11, 1994, in the middle of the Russian invasion of Chechnya, Russian performance artist Alexander Brenner goes to Red Square with boxing equipment in the middle of the war campaign and shouts in the direction of the Kremlin, Yeltsin, come out. This week in Radical History for December 13th, 1830, the state of Georgia makes it unlawful for Cherokee to meet in council, unless it is to propose the giving of lands to whites. Also on December 13th, 1908, Seattle police take anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman into custody after a lock on a closed hall is broken to allow Emma entry to speak. She is only released when she agrees to leave the city. This is just one of many cities that will not allow her to speak. After being booted from the city of Seattle, Emma Goldman protests the action of the police authority in Everett, Washington, who prevent her from speaking on the claims that vigilantes might harm her. The attempted exercise in free speech remains a farce until she reaches Canada. Emma is also arrested in Burlington, Washington, in anticipation of her scheduled speech there. Words can be dangerous. This week in Radical History for December 14th, 1763, 57 whites enter Conestoga Indian Settlement in violation of the treaty made between the tribe and William Penn. The treaty stated, quote, to last as long as the sun should shine, or the waters run in the rivers, unquote. The 57 whites shoot, stab, and hatchet 3 men, 2 women, and 1 young boy they found there. Also on that date in 1917, peace activist suffragette Kate Richardson O'Hare jailed 5 years for speech denouncing World War I and occupies a neighboring cell to Emma Goldman. O'Hare is one of the number of prisoners Eugene Debs cited in his Canton speech, for which he, in turn, would be imprisoned. More dangerous words. Two more quick items for this date. 1971, Detective Frank Serpico tells Knapp Commission of widespread police corruption in New York. There's a movie loosely based on his life starring Al Pacino. Also in 1972, in the holiday spirit, President Nixon authorizes the Christmas bombing of Hanoi. This has been This Week in Radical History, produced out of the mobile fortress of Glee Glee Studios. Apologies about last week's ending song, Prepare for Madness, and other great tunes can be found at MySpace as Underworld Superstars. Again, that's Underworld Superstars at the MySpace.com website. Underworld Superstars. Again, thanks for tuning into this week's show, and until next week's Radical History, I'll always and forever be yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon. Slaves or soldiers till you starve and your head is skewered on a stake. Now you can know where people are won. Now you can know where they get things done. What do you need, my son? What do you need, my son? It's a holiday in Cambodia where people dress in black. Need a holiday in Cambodia where no kids ask for crack.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. The main purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. What a difference a week makes. We began last week's program slamming President Obama for doing nothing about the Standing Rock pipeline issue. The criticism was made on the program last Sunday morning, and that very afternoon, the news was released that the Army Corps of Engineers was denying any permits to continue to build the pipeline under the Wahe River and through the Standing Rock sacred grounds. Great news. But what it really means for the future, given a Trump presidency, is difficult to predict. The company building the pipeline claims that it will continue with the project despite not having the proper permits, and Trump is offering support for the completion of the pipeline. Obama is on the way out, so who knows what will happen. But for the moment, a victory for the beleaguered Native Americans at Standing Rock. Now the question is, will Obama pardon Leonard Peltier in the waning days of his presidency? President Clinton was set to pardon him as he was about to leave the White House, but the FBI backed him down. Hopefully, President Obama will do the right thing. It's junket time in Massachusetts. So writes Nancy Murray in Mondo Weiss. She continues, the time of year when Massachusetts legislators enjoy an all-expense-paid trip to Israel is again upon us. Once again, a lobbying group, the Jewish Community Relations Council, JCRC, is planning the itinerary. According to JCRC Executive Director Jeremy Burton, over the past 5 years, he has personally accompanied almost a third of the entire Massachusetts legislature on trips to Israel and has been able to, quote, watch firsthand as our participants fall in love with the leaders and activists who've inspired and energized me for years, unquote. Soon after they return, the 12 state legislators participating in the current JCRC junket may vote on an anti-BDS legislation the JCRC has said it intends to introduce in the new legislative season beginning in January. The stakes this time are particularly high, given the fact that two previous efforts to enlist the Massachusetts legislature in the anti-BDS brigade were derailed by spirited activism spearheaded by the Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine, JVP Boston, and Massachusetts Peace Action, first in March of this year and then again in July. This legislative trip may seem like an obvious conflict of interest, but the State Ethics Commission does not see it that way. It rejected the ethics complaint filed by the Massachusetts Peace Action after JCRC took a quarter of the state Senate to Israel last year following a Senate vote on a pro-Israel resolution. It is not clear if the touring legislators will cross paths with the Massachusetts governor, Charles Baker, who leaves for Israel on December 9th on his first international trade mission. He will be accompanied by scores of government officials and private sector businessmen on a journey reportedly subsidized by the New England Israel Business Council with the support of Combined Jewish Philanthropies. Last month, Combined Jewish Philanthropies paid $25,000 for five Baker aides to visit Israel to prepare for the governor's trip. Governor Baker has already paid his anti-BDS dues. He is a signatory of the American Jewish Committee's sponsor's governor's letter that characterizes BDS as a virulent movement seeking to demonize Israel. And will the Massachusetts governor and legislators bump into the Boston Police Commissioner and law enforcement agents who are on yet another junket, this one sponsored by the Anti-Defamation League, ADL. The ADL, which in 1993 was revealed to have been conducting a massive spying operation on Arab Americans and other supporters of Palestinian rights and activists opposing South African apartheid, now offers annual trips to Israel for law enforcement to hone their counterterrorism skills. The last thing Boston needs is training in Israel-style racial profiling and surveillance and in the violent suppression of nonviolent popular resistance, such as that taking place on a weekly basis in the West Bank village of Bilayin. And the last thing Massachusetts needs is the Israeli right or wrong mentality and casual corruption that these junkets promote. That was an article written by Nancy Murray in Mondo Weiss. Our conversation with Iyad Bernat is our feature presentation this morning. Iyad heads the Popular Committee in Bialin in the West Bank of Palestine. The village referred to by Nancy Murray just a minute ago in her article, a village known for its tenacious resistance to occupation and in particular resistance to the building of the apartheid wall that has dissected the village's lands. Here is our conversation. Well, yeah, thank you for speaking with us on This Week in Palestine. We try as much as possible to feature the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative. And so we're grateful to you for agreeing to tell your story for those who are listening, because we consider you a really genuine voice for the Palestinian people. So welcome and thank you.
Thank you.
You're in the United States on a book tour. You'll be here in the Boston area and then I guess going out throughout the country. You've written a book called Bilayin and the Nonviolent Resistance. It is a story of your village and the courageous resistance you have carried on and continue to wage in the face of a brutal military occupation. So please tell us about Bilayin. Tell us about your village, its people, the occupation, and what's happened and what's happening now.
I live in Bilayin village from long time. All my life is in Bilayin. My father, my grandfather, all our life in Bilayin. Bilayin is under the occupation since 1967. It's a small village, 2,000 people live in Bilayin. The land of the village is about 4,000 dunams. They confiscated 60% from the land of the village to build a new apartheid wall and a settlement there, colony there. It's called Mektiaho East.
Mm-hmm.
So the story of our village, that's, as I said, we under the occupation and we refuse the occupation. We fighting for our freedom, like everybody in the world, to have justice, equality, peace, fighting for a better future for our children. So the occupation is continue until now, to confiscate the land of the village, to destroy the olive trees of the farmers. That's most of the people is the farmers in the village, and they used to have the olive trees as the economy of the village. So most of the people was selling olive oil. Now many of them, they have to buy it because of all these settlements and wall and all these confiscated of the land that's happened there in Bilayin. Bilayin is 16 kilometers west of Ramallah city, in West Bank. Like other villages around the world, the occupation confiscated about 10% from the 22% that's left for the Palestinians as after 1967 border. And also this 12% is now full of colonies inside of West Bank. And if you talk about the settlers who's moved to West Bank, it's about 700,000 settlers.
Mm-hmm. Now, how far is Bilayin from what we call the Green Line, the international?
It's not, the Green Line is the 1967 border.
Yeah.
It's about 7 kilometers.
Seven.
And these 7 kilometers between the wall and the Green Line is now full of settlements.
Right.
And these settlements, they built it after Oslo Agreement. You talk about 1993. And the biggest one now in where is Bilayin, and it's a new one in Mudayin Alid. Mm-hmm. Is in 10 years we have 60,000 people moved to these settlements. Most of them, they came from New York, the Orthodox, right, Jewish settlers. So this comes very fast, especially in this time that's all the world support the occupation, especially United States government, right, that support them, and they make the aid this year to up to $3.8 billion a year. It's about 11 or 12 million a day. Yeah. That's they sent to the occupation, to the army, to build more settlements, to occupy Palestine. So this is coming worse for the Palestinians, especially for the farmers. That they lost their land, they lost their jobs. And this is the idea of the Zionists from the beginning, to clean the land from the people. And by this way, is making the life hard for the Palestinians, difficult farmers, to give him move from their land, from their villages.
Yeah. So let me just go back a little bit. Israel says it builds the wall for security. But if it was building the wall for security, it would build the wall on the international green line. It's building the wall inside the green line. It's building the wall to basically protect settlements. The settlers are coming over onto Palestinian land, continuing to take Palestinian land, and Israel is building a wall to protect that land which they have taken. And it separates Palestinians from their land, their olive grove, their agricultural land, so that the wall really is a way to steal land. I mean, there's no other way to look at it. It's a way to take land that's not theirs and build a wall to keep the people out of land that's technically theirs. Is that a way to...
To be more clear in this point, what the United Nations mentioned, that they give 22% from the Palestinian historic land
right
to the Palestinians to build a Palestinian state.
Right, in the West Bank.
In West Bank. So what's they doing by building the wall? They confiscated 10% from the 22%. So
right,
what's left now is 12%. And this 12% of the Palestinian historic land is full of settlements.
Right.
Also, so the wall came to confiscate more land, to right, build more settlements, and to confiscate the water of the Palestinians.
Right.
We have a rich water in the Palestinian side in West Bank, in west of West Bank. So where the wall came, and it looks like when you see the wall on the map, it comes like snake to take more right, land. In Belayin, it's 7 kilometers from the green line, but in other cities and other places, it's become like 20 kilometers
right,
inside. So this is where the water, the big aquifer of the water came. They're stealing the water also. They give it to the settlements, and they sell it a little bit back from this water to Palestinians.
Right, at and four times the
yeah,
the rate they sell it to Israelis, I'm told. Is that...
Yeah, this Makarot company.
Yeah.
So this the goal of the wall. So as we said, if it's for security and you are against the walls, we didn't want walls. If we're talking about peace, why the walls? And what's about the settlements inside, the settlers inside of West Bank? If it's for security, what's
yeah,
about
right,
them? Why they didn't want security for them? So this... Just for a propaganda, that's to make the wall and to say about war that it's for security. It's not a for security. If you go to the ground, you can see the wall is just to take more land, to make the life hard for the Palestinians to live there and to move by themselves from this land. So people follow the news here, and we know the media didn't show the life of the Palestinians on the ground. They didn't show the occupation. And we believe that this media is controlled
yeah,
by these companies, by all these Zionist lobby that is control the media here, and they didn't show anything in the ground. But anybody who's coming to Palestine and he said he see by his own eyes what's going on, he's become our messenger.
Yeah.
He's believed that this is apartheid. When Tosman Tutu came to Belayin, he said it's worse than the apartheid in South Africa. Mm-hmm. When Jimmy Carter came, he said it's apartheid country, it's apartheid wall, illegal settlement. So these people, and we have many famous people that came and they saw from the ground what's happened there. So Palestinians now, if you go to Palestine now, to West Bank, you cannot move from city to city, from village to village, because of this wall and because of these settlements inside of West Bank, because of the borders, the checkpoints, that's everywhere. So you cannot move from place to place. You cannot go to Jerusalem as a Palestinian because of these checkpoints, and you need a permission and these things. So it's very hard life, and they mean to make it very hard for the Palestinians now to try to kick out how many Palestinians they can to build what they called it a Jewish state.
Okay, now tell us about the resistance. You heard that they were going to build a wall. You knew the settlements were there. Some of the settlements were there already. They're going to be building new settlements, and now they tell you they're going to build a wall. And tell us about the response of the village.
Yes, resistance in Bel'in started when the people saw the bulldozers destroyed the olive trees. Hmm. Olive trees is the life of the farmers.
Right.
And they refused that. We started our resistance in December 2004, and we used the nonviolent way in our struggle. We fight by our bodies. We put ourselves in cages and barrels. We tie ourselves to the olive trees. From that time, it's more than 12 years now, every week we have a demonstration. And every week we have internationally from all of the world join us in these demonstrations. We have an Israeli activist also that's join us in these demonstrations. As I said, we use a nonviolent way. We use many ideas in our demonstration, weekly demonstration, to get the message out to many people in the world. That's to show the life of the Palestinians, to show what's going on in Palestine, to show what's the Israelis doing now there. They never follow any agreement. They never agree with any international law, doing lots of things against the human rights. So this was to show the people and to get more people understand what's happened in Palestine and what's going on. So in other side, they use a lot of violence against us, to break this non-violent way. They didn't want this way to be grown in other places in Palestine. They didn't want the people outside to know about what's happened there, the life of the Palestinians. So they use lots of violence against us in Bel'in village and in other villages that we succeed to grow it in many places in Palestine, about 15 to 20 places now that's doing the weekly demonstration by non-violent way with international and Israeli activists around West Bank. So this was from the beginning. They started the violence against us. They killed two of our friends in this demonstration. Basim Abu Rahman, 17 of April 2009. That's, they shot him by tear gas canister made in the United States. It's make a big hole in his chest, and he's died in that place. 1st of January 2011, they killed his sister, Jawahar Abu Rahman. So this way of violence that they use it, it was... they always using a violence against the Palestinians everywhere, in Gaza, in West Bank, in all the demonstration. But they mean in this way to break the people by the violence because they didn't want to this message to get outside. And they know exactly that the way of nonviolent resistance is show the face of the violence. So they didn't want it to be grown or continue. They use many kinds of weapons against us in this demonstration, and most of these weapons comes from United States. It's illegal to use it against civilians. and they use it against the people.
So they're shooting tear gas canisters, but the canisters are acting like bullets. They're hitting people and killing people, and it's just not canisters of gas. It becomes a lethal weapon.
Yeah, it's illegal to use it by the international laws against civilians, and they use it in Belayin, and I said many kinds of these weapons that they use it, and we have more than 40 people being killed by these tear gas canisters and the rubber coat steel bullet. That's they use it against the people in these nonviolent demonstrations. More than 40 people being killed in nonviolent demonstrations. It means that's not a tear gas or rubber bullet. It's a weapon that's going to kill people.
And we're seeing that now in Standing Rock. We're seeing the use of that kind of weaponry at Standing Rock in North Dakota. A young woman had her arm just about torn off by one of these canisters. And it's been interesting to see how Palestinians and the Native Americans at Standing Rock have found commonality in the kind of struggle that's going on.
Yes, in Standing Rock, we send our support. We send a message to the people there because we support everybody in the world. He's asking for justice and peace when they try to take the water of the people or to the land of the farmers there. So we send a message from Belayin, from Palestine, to these people in Standing Rock. We're standing with all resistance that's fighting for justice, like Black Lives Matter. We support them. We support the Standing Rock. We support all the resistance, the revolution that's against dictators, against governments that try to push people and to control people by injustice way. So, yes, this is what they use in North Dakota against the Standing Rock, and this police been teaching by the Israeli police also. The Israeli police, they train them how to use this violence against these people. So it's the same struggle for justice. It's the same way how they use a violent against these people.
Mm-hmm. Israel's developed an entire industry around surveillance and means of control, military means of control and occupation, etc., that they're selling to the world. A lot of it is manufactured in the United States, but they're quite open in saying, well, these are tested. We've tested this on the Palestinian people. We know about occupation and sell it at Standing Rock or wherever, all throughout the world in terms of means to control populations. And so, you know, we see Palestinian people as we call them sort of the guinea pigs, that the people that they test this on, that they develop it on, and then they go and sell it. So,
yes, they use many kinds of weapons against us just to test it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very dangerous weapons. It's illegal to use it against civilians by the international law. They use it, and it's most made in the United States.
Yeah,
and it's not just these weapons they use against the civilians in nonviolent demonstrations. They use live bullet also. And they use it against my son. They shot my son in front of me. Also, they want to break this way by putting more pressure and send bad message to us as a family or as people in Belayin and other villages, just by killing people, shooting people, attacking the house at night times, arrested children, all these kinds of violence that they use it against us. It's just to break us. They didn't want this way to be grow and people know about it.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about how they break into homes at night, how they use these terror tactics, how they arrest kids, take them out of the home, take their parents out. It's just...
Yeah, it's really very hard to the night raids, especially when you have it sometimes every night.
Mm.
That's a big group of soldiers coming to the village, attacking the houses. And it's happened in my home many times. And these tactics is especially against the kids, against the children.
Yeah, that's...
And when you see 20 soldiers inside of the house, cover their faces with machine guns, with dogs inside of the house, and you have 5 children, they just wake everybody when he's sleeping, and you cannot imagine how much it's very dangerous against the children to be in this situation. 6 years old or 10 years
and
old.
And psychologically what that does.
Yeah, and it's, we have many problems, lots of problems with the children now, as psychology problems, because of these night raids. So this arrested children also is a bigger problem, and arrested children is to put a pressure on the families and in the parents to stop this resistance in Bel-Ain. They arrested 150, most of them as children. They put them in jail between 4 months to 18 months to break the family farmers. Also, they was putting lots of money against the children in the court to pay. So these ways that they use it, these tactics, these weapons that they use it week after week and day after. Just when I was here in this store, they raided the village 3 times at night time. They arrested 4 children, and they also on a Friday they arrested another one, 2 of my cousins. So it's continued. The violence is continued until now. It's the same. Mm. The building of the settlements is continued and very fast. So people should know about this.
Yeah.
What they're doing. So if you talk about 10 years later, next 10 years, you will not find Palestine.
Yeah.
So from 1948 until now, you have 12% from the Palestinian historic land that's left for the Palestinians, and it's like contornos.
Yeah.
People cannot live in this life, and this is what they want to do, just to make it more hard for the people to
isolate people.
Yeah. To leave from Palestine.
Tell us about the court victory. Tell us about your challenge of the wall in the ruling of the International Court and the Supreme Court of Israel.
It's when we started our resistance in Bel-Ain, we didn't just go by a demonstration, weekly demonstration. We're fighting by many ways. So we did our demonstrations in the ground, our resistance in the ground, and then we fight in the court, and we fight in the media, same ways. So the court was, in the beginning, they refused our call 3 times to the court to move the wall and this, but after that...
What were you challenging? Where the wall, I mean, you were challenging the existence of the very existence of the wall and also its placement, because the court really ruled, didn't say the wall was illegal, but it did move the wall. It did say that it was placed wrong. Is that right?
What Lahai's court said, that the wall is illegal and they have to demolish it.
And the international courts.
Yes, this is what they said, but they didn't care for an international law and they didn't follow anything. They continued to build the wall. In Bel-Ain, the case was, is we have our Israeli lawyers, Michael Spard, they refuse our call three times in the beginning, and we continue to fight in the court.
Mm-hmm.
Then after 2.5 years of our resistance in September 2007, we had a decision from the Israeli High Court to move the wall back 500 meters. So when they built the wall, they built it where is the last house in the village.
Hmm.
And they left a big place to build more and more houses and settlements. So in our fight, we in the court, we succeed to move it 500 meters back.
Okay, so you recovered some land.
Yes, we it means we have 1,200 dunams back to the farmers in Belayin. And also the succeed is to stop 2,000 apartments that's in the settlement, Mishtiya Hamuzra.
So you were successful in stopping 2,000 apartments from being built.
Yeah, so it's a big succeed for a small village.
Yeah,
and
yes.
It's the first time that's happened in Palestine. So if we have this in all Palestine, these demonstrations, it will be a big succeed.
Yeah. Tell us about your brother Imad and how he began documenting with photographs the what was happening and how that became Five Broken Cameras.
Yes, it's a different story. That's when my brother Imad, he's bought his camera or he's get his the first camera. It was to film his son that he's been born, new son, Jibril. And, you know, it started in the same time that the resistance in Belayin. So he was filming what's going on in the village when the soldiers raid the village at night, when they came in the day, he was filming the demonstrations. And he's tried to put this in YouTube. Every time
you
to
too.
Share,
yeah,
to share the message
sure.
and to do what's the
make it public.
Yeah, he didn't think that he will make a movie someday
right.
in the beginning, but you know the movie is now very famous. It's nominated to Oscar.
Right, came close to getting in
yes,
Oscar.
And it's also very important that this movie it's get a lot of attention
right.
after nominated to Oscar, and it shows that. How the people live, how under the occupation, how is a child grow with the violence of the Israeli army, how the farmer has lost his land and he's been, they arrested him for 18 months, or a simple man like Basim, he's a peaceful man, and how they shot him. So it's example of the Palestinians' life. And people didn't know about it here or in Europe or everywhere. So when they saw the movie of the Five Broken Cameras, it's very good. That's get a lot of people to understand the
right.
story in Palestine.
Yeah. That's what we need. That's what we need. Because we don't get that in the Western media here. We just don't get the big struggle is to get the Palestinian story out, to get the voice out, and our newspapers unfortunately just don't allow space in their pages for the Palestinian voice. They don't have it, and so when you get a breakthrough like Five Broken Cameras, it's important, it's amazing, it's wonderful.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, tell us in the last few minutes, where are we? Things look awfully bad from this side of the ocean in terms of what's happening in the West Bank. And I just wonder, you've been in this for so long, you must have some kind of a vision for the future, where your hope is. What is your vision? What is the hope going forward?
When we're fighting for a better future for our children.
Mm-hmm.
And we have hope that our children will be in a better future and all children. But in the ground, if you go there and if you see what's happened now in the ground, that's, you cannot talk about a solutions. That's what United Nations bought, like a two-state solution. Mm. They killed the two-state solution. So if you, they didn't, you know, there is no more talks about the two states.
No.
Because, you know, when you have 250 settlements inside of West Bank, when you have 700,000 settlers, when they continue to build, so it's make it, they make it one state. But they didn't want one state or two states. They want just one Jewish state.
Right.
This is what they're calling for. But we have hope to fight for one democratic state, to have justice, equality for everybody, rights for everybody to live in freedom and peace. So this is the only solution that we have. And I said they didn't want this solution, they didn't want another solution of two states, because they killed the two states. So we have to fight to put more pressure in the Israeli government to accept the international solution.
Okay, so what we have right now is one state. We have one apartheid state. We have a state that has a set of laws for Jewish people, a set of laws for other people. So you talk about one state, democratic, everyone has equal rights. That is, has to be a secular state. You can't have a Jewish state and give equal rights to everyone.
Yes.
And that's the struggle, I take it. That's the struggle, is to get, they have to give that up.
Yes.
And we have to have a state, secular state, for all people, equal rights.
Yes, this is what we fight for. Justice.
Mm-hmm.
And equality. So this is not coming, will not coming from the occupation.
No.
It's have to be more pressure from outside on the occupation to follow this solution.
In terms of positive actions going on around the world, what role do you think the BDS plays in this?
BDS is very important, and it's a part of the nonviolent resistance. So I would call everybody to join the BDS movement, mm-hmm. boycott, divestment, and sanction, to put more pressure in this government to follow the international laws, to accept and to stop building these settlements and this wall to make the life hard for the Palestinians. So BDS is very important. BDS is succeed in many ways, like against the apartheid in South Africa. Also, it was by boycott the apartheid in South Africa, mm-hmm. from outside,
right.
of the country, and they succeed to do it. So we call everybody to join the BDS against the occupation.
And it's important, because we know that Israel is hurting by the BDS, because they're really come out so strongly against it. They're getting their supporters in the United States in the legislatures to create laws,
yeah.
making BDS. I mean, so you know, it's working, and it is perhaps the major nonviolent weapon we have now to oppose the occupation.
Yes. Yes, it works, and it works in the United States, in Europe, in England, everywhere. It works, and people start to join this. But also, we have to educate people. We have to give him more information about the situation there, so they can. You have more people will join this. Yes, but you know, you have a strong Zionist lobby here in the United
yes.
States, and you have a strong media, that if you do anything against the occupation, they will call you anti-Semitic,
yeah.
or they call you a terrorist, or they throw words to scare the people.
Yeah.
But BDS is a part of the nonviolent resistance, and everybody have to join and to be in this part. At least because we didn't want the people to be silent.
Right.
We will not remember the words of our enemies, but we remember the words of our friends. So I think people didn't have to be silent, especially in the United States, and especially that your tax money goes to help the occupation, the army, to kill other people in the world. So they have to stand, they have to talk, at least to join this BDS movement.
Yeah, we have a lot of work here to do to support BDS and get out the Palestinian story. Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time. Iyad, thank you for sitting down with us. We've been following the plight of Bilayin. We've had people on this broadcast actually who have been there several times. So, and you've been here. I guess it was a year and a half ago we had you on. So we are watching this carefully, and we support you, and we hope that you'll be a frequent visitor here, because we really identify a lot with what's going on there. We identify with what's happening at Standing Rock, and it's important that all of us pull together to make a difference. So thank you very much.
Thank you. We try our best to, it's very hard, but we try our best to inform more people, to educate more people. Very hard to travel, to go outside, to give talks, but this is also one of our ways in nonviolent resistance, to educate more people and to get more people to understand the story.
That's important. That's right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was a conversation with Iyad Bernat, representing the Popular Committee of the Village of Bilayin in the West Bank of Palestine. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver.
Only soldiers, slaves, and the wretchedly poor had to rely on purchase, on theft, or on handouts. Urbanization was limited, and town markets only supplemented the diet of city dwellers, who still produced always part of their own sustenance.
And you give me your best, you know, and
cows, which for generations grow in stables, can't walk their hoofs off in a few miles.
We go there, an unwelcome guest.
You're listening to episode 744 of Unwelcome Guests. The Machine Stops. I'm Robin Upton. If that seems like a simple title, well, the subtitle is Three Wise Men on the Implications of Human Stabulation. Now, I have to look that word up. It means putting in stables. Normally not applied to human beings, but our first speaker, Ivan Illich, deliberately does so. He's actually speaking, introducing his book Medical Nemesis, 1974. You wouldn't know that from the talk, because it's taking a pan-institutional analysis, suggesting that the same problems which occur when individuals lose the capacity for caring for oneself and one another because of a larger healthcare system which attempts to do the same thing on an institutional basis, he's suggesting those problems also apply to the food system, and that all through history people have understood, well, I need food and therefore I'm going to work out how to get that myself, how to grow it. And he suggests that problems occur when people are put in sterile environments surrounded by concrete. It's very convenient, but it's also highly unnatural. Now, I thought these are important ideas that Illich has. Let's use it as introductory material. Then I thought, well, it's not actually that addressable. So I thought more important for me to let you know where I'm going with the show. And I thought, I'll try something different. Our main piece, the title piece, is a 70-minute short story, a science fiction from 1909. And it happens to fall into three chapters. So since I've got two pieces of material to juxtapose with it, so let's try a sandwich model without further ado, but with thanks to the good people from LibriVox.org who will introduce themselves.
Recording by Jenna Lee. The Machine Stops by E.M. Forster. Chapter 1. The Airship. Imagine, if you can, a small room, hexagonal in shape, like the cell of a bee. It is lighted neither by window nor by lamp, yet it is filled with a soft radiance. There are no apertures for ventilation, yet the air is fresh. There are no musical instruments, and yet, at the moment that my meditation opens, this room is throbbing with melodious sounds. An armchair is in the center, by its side a reading desk. That is all the furniture. And in the armchair there sits a swaddled lump of flesh. A woman, about 5 feet high, with a face as white as a fungus. It is to her that the little room belongs. An electric bell rang. The woman touched a switch, and the music was silent. "I suppose I must see who it is," she thought, and set her chair in motion. The chair, like the music, was worked by machinery, and it rolled her to the other side of the room, where the bell still rang importunately. "Who is it?" she called. Her voice was irritable, for she had been interrupted often since the music began. She knew several thousand people. In certain directions human intercourse had advanced enormously. But when she listened into the receiver, her white face wrinkled into smiles, and she said, "Very well, let us talk. I will isolate myself. I do not expect anything important will happen for the next 5 minutes. For I can give you fully 5 minutes, Kuno. Then I must deliver my lecture on music during the Australian period." She touched the isolation knob so that no one else could speak to her. Then she touched the lighting apparatus, and the little room was plunged into darkness. "Be quick," she called, her irritation returning. "Be quick, Kuno. Here I am in the dark, wasting my time." But it was fully 15 seconds before the round plate that she held in her hands began to glow. A faint blue light shot across it, darkening to purple, and presently she could see the image of her son, who lived on the other side of the earth, and he could see her. "Kuno, how slow you are." He smiled gravely. "I really believe you enjoy dawdling." "I have called you before, mother, but you were always busy or isolated. I have something particular to say." "What is it, dearest boy? Be quick. Why could you not send it by pneumatic post?" "Because I prefer saying such a thing. I want..." "Well?" "I want you to come and see me." Vashti watched his face in the blue plate. "But I can see you," she exclaimed. "What more do you want?" "I want to see you not through the machine," said Kuno. "I want to speak to you not through the wearisome machine." "Oh, hush," said his mother, vaguely shocked. "You mustn't say anything against the machine."
"Why not?"
"One mustn't."
"You talk as if God had made the machine," cried the other. "I believe that you pray to it when you are unhappy. Men made it, do not forget that. Great men, but men. The machine is much, but it is not everything. I see something like you in this plate, but I do not see you. I hear something like you through this telephone, but I do not hear you. That is why I want you to come. Pay me a visit, so that we can meet face to face and talk about the hopes that are in my mind." She replied that she could scarcely spare the time for a visit. "The airship barely takes 2 days to fly between me and you."
"I dislike airships."
"Why?"
"I dislike seeing the horrible brown earth, and the sea, and the stars when it is dark. I get no ideas in an airship."
"I do not get them anywhere else."
"What kind of ideas can the air give you?" He paused for an instant. "Do you not know 4 big stars that form an oblong, and 3 stars close together in the middle of the oblong, and hanging from these stars 3 other stars?"
"No, I do not. I dislike the stars. But did they give you an idea?"
"How interesting. Tell me."
"I had an idea that they were like a man."
"I do not understand."
"The 4 big stars are the man's shoulders and his knees. The 3 stars in the middle are like the belts that men wore once, and the 3 stars hanging are like a sword."
"A sword?"
"Men carried swords about with them, to kill animals and other men."
"It does not strike me as a very good idea, but it is certainly original. When did it come to you first?"
"In the airship." He broke off, and she fancied that he looked sad. She could not be sure, for the machine did not transmit nuances of expression. It only gave a general idea of people, an idea that was good enough for all practical purposes, Vashti thought. The imponderable bloom, declared by a discredited philosophy to the actual essence of intercourse, was rightly ignored by the machine, just as the imponderable bloom of the grape was ignored by the manufacturers of artificial fruit. Something good enough had long since been accepted by our race. "The truth is," he continued, "that I want to see these stars again. They are curious stars. I want to see them not from the airship, but from the surface of the earth, as our ancestors did, thousands of years ago. I want to visit the surface of the earth." She was shocked again. "Mother, you must come, if only to explain to me what is the harm of visiting the surface of the earth."
"No harm," she replied, controlling herself, "but no advantage. The surface of the earth is only dust and mud, no advantage. The surface of the earth is only dust and mud, no life remains on it, and you would need a respirator, or the cold of the outer air would kill you. One dies immediately in the outer air."
"I know. Of course I shall take all precautions."
"And besides..."
"Well?"
She considered and chose her words with care. Her son had a queer temper, and she wished to dissuade him from the expedition. "It is contrary to the spirit of the age," she asserted.
"Do you mean by that, contrary to the machine?"
"In a sense, but..." His image in the blue plate faded. "Kuno!"
He had isolated himself.
For a moment, Vashti felt lonely. Then she generated the light, and the sight of her room, flooded with radiance and studded with electric buttons, revived her. There were buttons and switches everywhere. Buttons to call for food, for music, for clothing. There was the hot bath button, by pressure of which a basin of imitation marble rose out of the floor, filled to the brim with a warm, deodorized liquid. There was the cold bath button. There was the button that produced literature. And there were, of course, the buttons by which she communicated with her friends. The room, though it contained nothing, was in touch with all that she cared for in the world. Vashti's next move was to turn off the isolation switch, and all the accumulations of the last 3 minutes burst upon her. The room was filled with the noise of bells and speaking tubes,
What was the new food like? Could she recommend it? Has she had any ideas lately? Might one tell her one's own ideas? Would she make an engagement to visit the public nurseries at an early date, say this day and month? To most of these questions she replied with irritation, a growing quality in that accelerated age. She said that the new food was horrible, that she could not visit the public nurseries through press of engagements, that she had no ideas of her own but had just been told one, that 4 stars and 3 in the middle were like a man. She doubted there was much in it. Then she switched off her correspondence, for it was time to deliver her lecture on Australian music. The clumsy system of public gatherings had been long since abandoned. Neither Vashti nor her audience stirred from their rooms. Seated in her armchair she spoke, while they in their armchairs heard her fairly well and saw her fairly well. She opened with a humorous account of music in the pre-Mongolian epoch, and went on to describe the great outburst of song that followed the Chinese conquest. Remote and primeval as were the methods of I San So and the Brisbane School, she yet felt, she said, that study of them might repay the musicians of today. They had freshness, they had, above all, ideas. Her lecture, which lasted 10 minutes, was well received, and at its conclusion she and many of her audience listened to a lecture on the sea. There were ideas to be got from the sea. The speaker had donned a respirator and visited it lately. Then she fed, talked to many friends, had a bath, talked again, and summoned her bed. The bed was not to her liking. It was too large, and she had a feeling for a small bed. Complaint was useless, for beds were of the same dimension all over the world, and to have had an alternative size would have involved vast alterations in the machine. Vashti isolated herself. It was necessary, for neither day nor night existed under the ground, and reviewed all that had happened since she had summoned the bed last. Ideas? Scarcely any. Events? Was Kuno's invitation an event? By her side, on the little reading desk, was a survival from the ages of litter, one book. This was the book of the machine. In it were instructions against every possible contingency. If she was hot or cold or dyspeptic or at a loss for a word, she went to the book and it told her which button to press. The Central Committee published it. In accordance with the growing habit, it was richly bound. Sitting up in the bed, she took it reverently in her hands. She glanced round the glowing room as if someone might be watching her. Then, half ashamed, half joyful, she murmured, "Oh, machine! Oh, machine!" and raised the volume to her lips. Thrice she kissed it, thrice inclined her head, thrice she felt the delirium of acquiescence. Her ritual performed, she turned to page 1367, which gave the times of the departure of the airships from the island in the southern hemisphere, under whose soil she lived, to the island in the northern hemisphere, whereunder lived her son. She thought, "I have not the time." She made the room dark and slept. She woke and made the room light. She ate and exchanged ideas with her friends, and listened to music and attended lectures. She made the room dark and slept. Above her, beneath her, and around her, the machine hummed eternally. She did not notice the noise, for she had been born with it in her ears. The earth, carrying her, hummed as it sped through silence, turning her now to the invisible sun, now to the invisible stars. She awoke and made the room light. "Kuno!" "I will not talk to you," he answered, "until you come." "Have you been on the surface of the earth since we spoke last?" His image faded. Again she consulted the book. She became very nervous and lay back in her chair palpitating. Think of her as without teeth or hair. Presently she directed the chair to the wall and pressed an unfamiliar button. The wall swung apart slowly. Through the opening she saw a tunnel that curved slightly, so that its goal was not visible. Should she go to see her son, here was the beginning of the journey. Of course, she knew all about the communication system. There was nothing mysterious in it. She would summon a car, and it would fly with her down the tunnel until it reached the lift that communicated with the airship station. The system had been in use for many, many years, long before the universal establishment of the machine. And of course, she had studied the civilization that had immediately preceded her own. The civilization that had mistaken the functions of the system, and had used it for bringing people to things instead of for bringing things to people. those funny old days when men went for change of air instead of changing the air in their rooms. And yet, she was frightened of the tunnel. She had not seen it since her last child was born. It curved, but not quite as she remembered. It was brilliant, but not quite as brilliant as a lecturer had suggested. Vashti was seized with the terrors of direct experience. She shrank back into the room, and the wall closed up again. "Kuno," she said, "I cannot come to see you. I am not well." Immediately, an enormous apparatus fell onto her out of the ceiling. A thermometer was automatically laid upon her heart. She lay powerless. Cool pads soothed her forehead. Kuno had telegraphed to her doctor. So the human passions still blundered up and down in the machine. Vashti drank the medicine that the doctor projected into her mouth, and the machinery retired into the ceiling. The voice of Kuno was heard asking how she felt. "Better," then with irritation, "but why do you not come to me instead?"
"Because I cannot leave this place."
"Why?"
"Because, any moment, something tremendous may happen."
"Have you been on the surface of the earth yet?"
"Not yet."
"Then what is it?"
"I will not tell you through the machine." She resumed her life. But she thought of Kuno as a baby, his birth, his removal to the public nurseries, her own visit to him there, his visits to her, visits which stopped when the machine had assigned him a room on the other side of the earth. "Parents, duties of," said the book of the machine, "cease at the moment of birth. Paragraph 422327483. True, but there was something special about Kuno. Indeed, there had been something special about all her children, and, after all, she must brave the journey if he desired it. And something tremendous might happen. What did that mean? The nonsense of a youthful man, no doubt, but she must go. Again she pressed the unfamiliar button, again the wall swung back, and she saw the tunnel that curves out of sight. Clasping the book, she rose, tottered onto the platform, and summoned the car. Her room closed behind her. The journey to the northern hemisphere had begun. Of course, it was perfectly easy. The car approached, and in it she found armchairs exactly like her own. When she signaled, it stopped, and she tottered into the lift. One other passenger was in the lift, the first fellow creature she had seen face to face for months. Few traveled in these days, for, thanks to the advance of science, the earth was exactly alike all over. Rapid intercourse, from which the previous civilization had hoped so much, had ended by defeating itself. What was the good of going to Peking when it was just like Shrewsbury? Why return to Shrewsbury when it would all be like Peking? Men seldom moved their bodies. All unrest was concentrated in the soul. The airship service was a relic from the former age. It was kept up because it was easier to keep it up than to stop it or to diminish it, but it now far exceeded the wants of the population. Vessel after vessel would rise from the vomitories of Rye or of Christchurch, I use the antique names, would sail into the crowded sky, and would draw up at the wharves of the south, empty. So nicely adjusted was the system, so independent of meteorology, that the sky, whether calm or cloudy, resembled a vast kaleidoscope whereon the same patterns periodically recurred. The ship on which Vashti sailed started now at sunset, now at dawn. But always, as it passed above Reyes, it would neighbor the ship that served between Helsingfors and the Brazils, and, every third time it surmounted the Alps, the fleet of Palermo would cross its track behind. Night and day, wind and storm, tide and earthquake, impeded man no longer. He had harnessed Leviathan. All the old literature, with its praise of nature and its fear of nature, rang false as the prattle of a child. Yet, as Vashti saw the vast flank of the ship, stained with exposure to the outer air, her horror of direct experience returned. It was not quite like the airship in the cinema to Fote. For one thing, it smelt. Not strongly or unpleasantly, but it did smell, and with her eyes shut she should have known that a new thing was close to her. Then she had to walk to it from the lift, had to submit to glances from the other passengers. The man in front dropped his book. No great matter, but it disquieted them all. In the rooms, if the book was dropped, the floor raised it mechanically. But the gangway to the airship was not so prepared, and the sacred volume lay motionless. They stopped, The thing was unforeseen, and the man, instead of picking up his property, felt the muscles of his arm to see how they had failed him. Then someone actually said with direct utterance, "We shall be late," and they trooped on board, Vashti treading on the pages as she did so. Inside, her anxiety increased. The arrangements were old-fashioned and rough. There was even a female attendant to whom she would have to announce her wants during the voyage. Of course, a revolving platform ran the length of the boat, but she was expected to walk from it to her cabin. Some cabins were better than others, and she did not get the best. She thought the attendant had been unfair, and spasms of rage shook her. The glass valves had closed. She could not go back. She saw, at the end of the vestibule, the lift in which she had ascended going quietly up and down, empty. Beneath those corridors of shining tiles were rooms, tier below tier, reaching far into the earth, and in each room there sat a human being, eating or sleeping or producing ideas, and buried deep in the hive was her own room. Vashti was afraid. "Oh, machine," she murmured and caressed her book, and was comforted. Then the sides of the vestibule seemed to melt together, as do the passages that we see in dreams. The lift vanished. The book that had been dropped slid to the left and vanished. Polished tiles rushed by like a stream of water. There was a slight jar, and the airship, issuing from its tunnel, soared above the waters of a tropical ocean. It was night. For a moment she saw the coast of Sumatra edged by the phosphorescence of waves, and crowned by lighthouses, still sending forth their disregarded beams. These also vanished, and only the stars distracted her. They were not motionless, but swayed to and fro above her head, thronging out of one skylight into another, as if the universe and not the airship was careening. And, as often happens on clear nights, they seemed now to be in perspective, now on a plane, now piled tier beyond tier into the infinite heavens, now concealing infinity, a roof limiting forever the visions of men. In either case they seemed intolerable. "Are we to travel in the dark?" called the passengers angrily, and the attendant, who had been careless, generated the light and pulled down the blinds of pliable metal. When the airships had been built, the desire to look direct at things still lingered in the world. Hence the extraordinary number of skylights and windows, and the proportionate discomfort to those who were civilized and refined. Even in Vashti's cabin one star peeped through a flaw in the blind, and after a few hours' uneasy slumber, she was disturbed by an unfamiliar glow, which was the dawn. Quick as the ship had sped westwards, the earth had rolled eastwards quicker still, and had dragged back Vashti and her companions towards the sun. Science could prolong the night, but only for a little, and those high hopes of neutralizing the earth's diurnal revolution had passed, together with hopes that were possibly higher. To keep pace with the sun, or even to outstrip it, had been the aim of the civilization preceding this. Racing aeroplanes had been built for the purpose, capable of enormous speed, and steered by the greatest intellects of the epoch. Round the globe they went, round and round, westward, westward, round and round, amidst humanity's applause. In vain. The globe went eastward quicker still, horrible accidents occurred, and the committee of the machine, at the time rising into prominence, declared the pursuit illegal, unmechanical, and punishable by homelessness. Of homelessness more will be said later. Doubtless the committee was right, yet the attempt to defeat the sun aroused the last common interest that our race experienced about the heavenly bodies, or indeed about anything. It was the last time that men were compacted by thinking of a power outside the world. The sun had conquered, yet it was the end of his spiritual dominion. Dawn, midday, twilight, the zodiacal path, touched neither men's lives nor their hearts, and science retreated into the ground, to concentrate herself upon problems that she was certain of solving. So when Vashti found her cabin invaded by a rosy finger of light, she was annoyed, and tried to adjust the blind. But the blind flew up altogether, and she saw through the skylight small pink clouds, swaying against a background of blue. And as the sun crept higher, its radiance entered direct, brimming down the wall like a golden sea. It rose and fell with the airship's motion, just as waves rise and fall, but it advanced steadily, as a tide advances. Unless she was careful, it would strike her face. A spasm of horror shook her, and she rang for the attendant. The attendant, too, was horrified, but she could do nothing. It was not her place to mend the blind. She could only suggest that the lady should change her cabin, which she accordingly prepared to do. People were almost exactly alike all over the world, but the attendant of the airship, perhaps owing to her exceptional duties, had grown a little out of the common. She had often to address passengers with direct speech, and this had given her a certain roughness and originality of manner. When Vashti swerved away from the sunbeams with a cry, she behaved barbarically. She put out her hand to steady her. "How dare you!" exclaimed the passenger. "You forget yourself!" The woman was confused and apologized for not having let her fall. People never touched one another. The custom had become obsolete owing to the machine. "Where are we now?" asked Vashti haughtily. "We are over Asia," said the attendant, anxious to be polite. "Asia?" "You must excuse my common way of speaking. I have got into the habit of calling places over which I pass by their unmechanical names." "Oh, I remember Asia. The Mongols come from it." Beneath us, in the open air, stood a city that was once called Simla. "Have you ever heard of the Mongols and of the Brisbane school?" "No." Brisbane also stood in the open air. "Those mountains to the right, let me show you them." She pushed back a metal blind. The main chain of the Himalayas was revealed. "They were once called the roof of the world, those mountains. You must remember that, before the dawn of civilization, they seemed to be an impenetrable wall that touched the stars. It was supposed that no one but the gods could exist above their summits. How we have advanced, thanks to the machine." "How we have advanced, thanks to the machine," said Vashti. "How we have advanced, thanks to the machine," echoed the passenger, who had dropped his book the night before, and who was standing in the passage. "And that white stuff in the cracks? What is it?" "I have forgotten its name." "Cover the windows, please. The mountains give me no ideas." The northern aspect of the Himalayas was in deep shadow. On the Indian slope the sun had just prevailed. The forests had been destroyed during the literature epoch for the purpose of making newspaper pulp, but the snows were awakening to their morning glory, and clouds still hung on the breasts of Kinchinjunga. In the plain were seen the ruins of cities, with diminished rivers creeping by their walls, and by the sides of these were sometimes the signs of vomitories, marking the cities of today. Over the whole prospect airships rushed, crossing the intercrossing with incredible aplomb, and rising nonchalantly when they desired to escape the perturbations of the lower atmosphere and to traverse the roof of the world. "We have indeed advanced, thanks to the machine," repeated the attendant, and hid the Himalayas behind a metal blind. The day dragged wearily forward. The passengers sat each in his cabin, avoiding one another with an almost physical repulsion, and longing to be once more under the surface of the earth. There were 8 or 10 of them, mostly young males, sent out from the public nurseries to inhabit the rooms of those who had died in various parts of the earth. The man who had dropped his book was on the homeward journey. He had been sent to Sumatra for the purpose of propagating the race. Vashti alone was traveling by her own private will. At midday she took a second glance at the earth. The airship was crossing another range of mountains, but she could see little owing to clouds. Masses of black rock hovered below her and merged indistinctly into gray. Their shapes were fantastic. One of them resembled a prostrate man. "No ideas here," murmured Vashti, and hid the Caucasus behind a metal blind. In the evening she looked again. They were crossing a golden sea, in which lay many small islands and one peninsula. She repeated, "No ideas here," and hid Greece behind a metal blind. End of chapter 1.
Now, let's continue with that Ivan Illich recording. This turned up on YouTube, and I think it is from December 1974. I can't say a lot more about it, other than, well, it's actually a video. You don't really gain a lot from seeing a blurred image of Illich. But for the sake of protocol, I shall link to the original source material from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguest.net/744.
With autonomy and consciousness in the people who are engaged in constantly coping with their environment, which we call is a living, and therefore medicine must smother health. The same can be said in every domain where the autonomous production of use value and the heteronomous production of exchange value are in conflict, as they are now more and more in more and more sectors. This is my hypothesis about the so-called crisis in which we are. This synergy of these two modes of production, autonomous I do, and heteronomous I things, staple things made for me, remains positive only as long as technological inputs increase the effectiveness on both sides of the balance, on both sides of the scale. Unfortunately, this is not what is happening. Because of an ideological prejudice in favor of centralized, as you just said, professional production, technological advance is almost inevitably put at the disposal of an increased effectiveness on the heteronomous side, on the industrial side, into industrial mode of production. As soon as technological progress benefits the mass production of staples for people, and does so beyond a certain proportion, people's ability to fend for themselves cannot but decline, because society is rearranged for maximum effectiveness in industrial production. Society is drafted as an entity into the service of industry. Law then becomes a tool for the social engineering of producers and consumers. And politics becomes a squabble about who gets more, even though now all can do less on their own. In other words, the synergy of autonomous activity and heteronomous delivery, or if you want to put it in other words, of personal doing and institutional making, the synergy between the two major modes of production, in the case of such an unbalance, gives negative returns. And this synergy, this negative result of synergy between industrial and autonomous production, results in a misery of a new kind. This is what is new about the moment which we are living. Educated stupidity, iatrogenic ill health, high-speed wastage of time, luxury imprisonment, institutionally liberated sex, informational overload, these are all products of negative institutional synergy. I believe, and this is where I risk to state a hypothesis, that contemporary famine belongs to the same ilk of misery. The hunger which creates the world, which threatens the world, is a new kind of phenomenon. Of course, hunger is one of the oldest companions of man. But I do believe that we cannot really manage what we are facing during the next 10 or 15 years unless we see in which sense it is new. We remain powerless to counter it unless we understand that the famine which comes is unlike any famine of old. This point, I know, is difficult to make and difficult to swallow. And I beg, if there are again some of our colleagues here who were here last time, who on this point see different from me, forgive me for rubbing it in again. It's difficult to make and difficult to swallow because people who are done in by hunger tend all to look alike, and all evoke in us the urge to provide them with a bowl of soup. We have simply not been trained to distinguish the personal neighbor, this guy who is hungry, from the ad in the paper representing the victim of an impersonal catastrophe somewhere else. We are easily talked into, look here, this is a kid whom you should help. Look how he looks. Industrial and missionary vanity and presumption have grown hand in hand over the last 150 years. Imperialism
and missionarism. The conviction that the rich must be able to help the poor. The time now has come to understand that the family next door can eat well for Christmas if I hand them £10, perhaps. While famine in Bengal requires that we all, I first always, give up not only cars, perhaps flying in jet planes too. First of all. Now, professional do-gooders systematically confuse this issue. We fill the papers with pictures of bloated bellies and matchstick limbs, and piously appeal to you to close your eyes to the structural issue which is facing us by giving a pound for bureaucratic administration of relief, which will be very effective and decent indeed. The issue I want to bring to your attention cannot be grasped by you unless you renounce, we all renounce, in deep anguish, to be a conviction that we must have somehow the power to help, and then understand that there is nothing we can do for people who this year, next year, and the year after will die. You understand why I'm worried about this and said, I would like to discuss this, but in a milieu in which we are among ourselves, because I'm raising something which is just very difficult to put into words. What I want to discuss is the epidemic starvation which now decimates the marginal majorities of an industrialized mankind, which has been inescapably stabulated in a landscape of sterile concrete, and which is increasingly fed from mechanized farms. I want to explore if there are limits to man's capacity for stabulation. I remember 31 years ago, 32 years ago, my war experiences were saving Tuscany cows. My hero is Dujour. And to find out where the Germans would requisition cows and then somehow get them out of the stable and into the mafia. Which wasn't an easy job to do, because these were stabulated cows. And cows, which for generations grow in stables, can't walk their hoofs off in a few miles. When I therefore speak about the ability of man to resist stabulation, it is this kind of experience which I want to talk about. Obviously, by what I've said, if I said it properly, I've not only touched upon something which is obscenum, which really doesn't fit on the table of a decent discussion, and on the other hand, I've said something which very easily sounds as a call back to nature. This was a man who came today to interview me, and he wanted to discuss medical nemesis. He said, but you know, I didn't have really time to read it, but I have to write about it, so let me read what's on the back of it. He hadn't done even that. And then he said, oh, what kind of health foods do you eat? And I told him, I don't. He said, well, you jog, no? No, I don't want to. When I speak about what I want to do is to raise the hypothesis that a law which seems to apply in five or six other areas where I've carefully thought it through, namely that there are two modes of production, and when one prevails, the heteronomous mode prevails, total effectiveness becomes negative. If that is applicable in the field of food production. Now, as soon as I say this, people say, well, hey, you're speaking about something which is totally impossible. We can't go back and raise our own food. After all, city people never did. Now, this is not true. We tend to forget that until quite recently, very few people lived on packaged and marketed stall-fed fodder. I still am struggling for the right words to speak about this. Not only the peasant was engaged in the production of food, the typical 18th century townsman contributed sizably to his own subsistence, or sustenance. On his garbage and the crumbs from his table, he raised chicken and rabbits in Europe and carps in the East. Pigs and goats contributed warmth to his home. Backyards were common, the fruit trees and vegetable gardens. Many burghers had at least a family, if not property, just beyond the city gates. And I remember living in a college in the very center of Rome, behind Montecitorio, where the rules which were read to us every year at the beginning of the year so that the newcomers would know about them, forbade during the half-hour interruption to walk out into the vineyards. We sometimes forget about the size of traditional cities, even Rome. Excepting a few ports, I didn't dare to say this until very recently, but I think I'm not wrong, until very recently, 99% of the grain, oil, wine, and fruit came from within the horizon one could survey from the townspeople, not to speak about the wood and charcoal needed for its cooking. I'm speaking of city dwellers. Besides cattle and salt, which sometimes came from afar, but was precious and rare, and also, of course, pepper and drugs, which were light and very precious, food did not travel from region to region. But more significant for our purpose is the fact that only a very limited part of the local food passed over the market. I except here a few port cities. Only soldiers, slaves, and the wretchedly poor had to rely on purchase, on theft, or on handouts. Urbanization was limited, and town markets only supplemented the diet of city dwellers, who still produced always part of their own sustenance. The literature on this subject is rather new for me. I do hope that in your milieu I'll get more of it. When famine struck, food, of course, vanished from the market. Its price shot up 3 to 12-fold. Such an increase was steep enough to starve rich and poor alike. There just was no food. Food was gone. Stocks might save the king's men in a fortified stronghold, but for most people, famine was an inescapable fate, moderated only by what they could produce in a domestic way, in the domestic mode of production. How well is Salins known here now? Marshall Salins, Stone Age Economics. One moment. Who of you has read that? You please put it out. And this is a discovery for me. It's already 2 years on the market. I discovered it last year. Salins, S-A-H-L-I-N-S. If there is a Stone Age Economics. For me, it's one of the most enlightening books I've seen. A survey of the literature on Paleolithic people then and now, that is from archaeology and ethnology, and an attempt to study their production in a strict, from a strictly economist's point of view, coming to surprising results. I'm not saying that we should go back to the Stone Age. With Paul Goodman, I'm saying I'm a conservative Neolithic, but not a Paleolithic. Food traditionally was immobile, except by waterway. When famine became severe, people moved in search of food. In northeastern Brazil, people still land in the slums on the seashore if they don't die on the way. Then drought strikes. Periodic starvation cruelly kept each region's population within each region's nurturing potential. The obvious necessity to live off the soil, and of course of the sun, available in a certain circle, which was determined essentially by the donkey's autonomy, became a material parameter for the development of most peasant cultures. The rules governing land reform, marriage, child-rearing, and dying can be interpreted in each culture as devices to ensure survival of a well-knit group hitched in and kept down by famine. The relationship of man to hunger changed radically only
during the railroad age. Food became mobile. A world marketing foodstuff became possible. The new possibility of long-distance feeding not only called forth a new capital-intensive, mechanized kind of farming, but principally, and this is the issue I want to take up, a new fantasy about human interdependence, that which I called the missionary imperialist conviction about the rich man's power to help. A pest or a famine in Bengal was for two reasons a different experience in the time of Nelson and in the time of Disraeli. Before the telegraph could report on it, the apocalyptic rider of death might have passed before his appearance had been really noticed in London. And anyway, famine relief out of London could never be effective. Last year's famine in the Sahel was quite different. Londoners knew about its coming. 2 years before, one Tuareg really could speak about it, at least in the language of London. And they knew all the time more about it in more detail than anybody in High Volta or Niger. We know that the pet food which is used in England, just that much, if it were transported at 3% of the vacation air travel done in 1973, could have provided the emergency staples needed. No question about that. At first sight, this would seem that famine could be conjured by inter-regional assistance or by outright gift. In which combines, agricultural combines, and transfer belts are standard. In fact, this is wistful thinking. It is wistful thinking developed to protect the rich man's confidence in his industrial delusion. There are limits within which Bengalis can survive on grains from the Punjab, not to speak from grains from Kansas. The recent FAO meeting even has finally given official recognition to this fact, that disaster can be alleviated by shipment from stocks, but only to relieve occasional failures, if the region in itself is self-supporting. I see that I have talked longer than I wanted to. So let me sum up the end somewhat shorter than I had planned, because we want to come into conversation. I do believe that if we apply the hypothesis of the two modes of production and of negative synergy which sets in when one mode outgrows the balance to the agricultural production of food, we would need to find some parameters according to which we can define when agricultural production, inevitably mechanized production, must become counterproductive. I have played around and would like, during the seminar in Cuernavaca this year, to discuss two hypotheses. One would be to figure out what percentage of the total food value needed in a large...
Now, I'm afraid it ends there rather abruptly. I have this to say on the matter of growing food and growing food in cities. It's not easy to grow a large proportion of your food in a city. I don't think it's impossible. Depending upon land use, land ownership, you may find it's actually easier than you think if you really set your mind to it. And even if, like myself, you've only succeeded in growing a small proportion of your food, a few percent, even that much, I have found very, very helpful to ground me, to contribute to my well-being in other ways than just nutrition and calorific. So I highly recommend the practice of growing food, even if it seems impractical, unfeasible, difficult. Now, as far as Bangladesh goes, I must give special credit to the Bangladeshis here, because this is a country in which the majority of people still grow their own food. and that allows them to be very independent, thinking the village people, a lot of them don't have electricity or gas or anything that the government can turn off. Usually they've got mobile phones now. That's come in since I've been living here. I remember when a friend of mine came to visit and we hadn't had electricity in the village for a month due to a hurricane, and he was quite impressed by the Bangladeshi's, the villagers' relaxed attitude. Well, we'll see whether they bring the electricity back next month. It just wasn't a major factor. He could really understand that the Bangladeshis had something which the citizens of the so-called developed countries had lost a long time ago. The process of stabilization, as Illich describes it, in Britain, of course, has taken centuries. So it's a much longer time ago. My direct ancestors were forced off the land and put into a position of de facto dependency upon the system. I've got a lot more things to say about money, about when you're growing for yourself and your friends, then that is effectively a gift economy situation. When unknown institutions and companies are producing food, that is a market economy. But I'm going to save those thoughts for another time. Let's continue with The Machine Stops.
Recording by Aaron Tavano. Chapter 2, The Mending Apparatus. By a vestibule, by a lift, by a tubular railway, by a platform, by a sliding door, by reversing all the steps of her departure did Vashti arrive at her son's room, which exactly resembled her own. She might well declare that the visit was superfluous. The buttons, the knobs, the reading desk with the book, the temperature, the atmosphere, the illumination, all were exactly the same. And if Kuno himself, flesh of her flesh, stood close beside her at last, what profit was there in that? She was too well-bred to shake him by the hand. Averting her eyes, she spoke as follows. Here I am. I have had the most terrible journey and greatly retarded the development of my soul. It is not worth it, Kuno, it is not worth it. My time is too precious. The sunlight almost touched me, and I have met with the rudest people. I can only stop a few minutes. Say what you want to say, and then I must return. I have been threatened with homelessness, said Kuno. She looked at him now. I have been threatened with homelessness, and I could not tell you such a thing through the machine. Homelessness means death. The victim is exposed to the air, which kills him. I have been outside since I spoke to you last. The tremendous thing has happened, and they have discovered me. But why shouldn't you go outside? She exclaimed. It is perfectly legal, perfectly mechanical, to visit the surface of the earth. I have lately been to a lecture on the sea. There is no objection in that. One simply summons a respirator and gets an aggression permit. It is not the kind of thing that spiritually minded people do, and I begged you not to do it, but there is no legal objection to it. I did not get an aggression permit. Then how did you get out? I found out a way of my own. The phrase conveyed no meaning to her, and he had to repeat it. A way of your own? She whispered. But that would be wrong. Why? The question shocked her beyond measure. You are beginning to worship the machine, he said coldly. You think it irreligious of me to have found out a way of my own. It was just what the committee thought when they threatened me with homelessness. At this she grew angry. I worship nothing, she cried. I am most advanced. I don't think you irreligious, for there is no such thing as religion left. All the fear and the superstition that existed once have been destroyed by the machine. I only meant that to find out a way of your own was... Besides, there is no new way out. So it is always supposed. Except through the vomitories, for which one must have an aggression permit, it is impossible to get out. The book says so. Well, the book's wrong, for I have been out on my feet. For Kuno was possessed of a certain physical strength. By these days it was a demerit to be muscular. Each infant was examined at birth, and all who promised undue strength were destroyed. Humanitarians may protest, but it would have been no true kindness to let an athlete live. He would never have been happy in that state of life to which the machine had called him. He would have yearned for trees to climb, rivers to bathe in, meadows and hills against which he might measure his body. Man must be adapted to his surroundings, must he not? In the dawn of our world, our weakly must be exposed on Mount Taygetus. In its twilight, our strong will suffer euthanasia, that the machine may progress, that the machine may progress, that the machine may progress eternally. You know, we have lost the sense of space. We say space is annihilated, but we have annihilated not space, but the sense thereof. We have lost a part of ourselves. I determined to recover it, and I began by walking up and down the platform of the railway outside my room, up and down, until I was tired, and so did recapture the meaning of near and far. Near is a place to which I can get quickly, on my feet, not a place to which the train or the airship will take me quickly. Far is a place to which I cannot get quickly on my feet. The vomitory is far, though I could be there in 38 seconds by summoning the train. Man is the measure. That was my first lesson. Man's feet are the measure for distance. His hands are the measure for ownership. His body is the measure for all that is lovable and desirable and strong. Then I went further, and it was then that I called to you for the first time, and you would not come. This city, as you know, is built deep beneath the surface of the earth, with only the vomitories protruding. Having paced the platform outside my own room, I took the lift to the next platform and paced that also, and so with each in turn, until I came to the topmost, above which begins the earth. All the platforms were exactly alike, and all that I gained by visiting them was to develop my sense of space and my muscles. I think I should have been content with this. It is not a little thing. But as I walked and brooded, it occurred to me that our cities had been built in the days when men still breathed the outer air, and that there had been ventilation shafts for the workmen. I could think of nothing but these ventilation shafts. Had they been destroyed by all the food tubes and medicine tubes and music tubes that the machine has evolved lately? Or did traces of them remain? One thing was certain. If I came upon them anywhere, it would be in the railway tunnels of the topmost story. Everywhere else, all space was accounted for. I am telling my story quickly, but don't think that I was not a coward or that your answers never depressed me. It is not the proper thing. It is not mechanical. It is not decent to walk along a railway tunnel. I did not fear that I might tread upon a live rail and be killed. I feared something far more intangible, doing what was not contemplated by the machine. Then I said to myself, "Man is the measure." And I went, and after many visits, I found an opening. The tunnels, of course, were lighted. Everything is light, artificial light. Darkness is the exception. So when I saw a black gap in the tiles, I knew it was an exception and rejoiced. I put in my arm, I could put in no more at first, and waved it round and round in ecstasy. I loosened another tile and put in my head and shouted into the darkness, "I am coming, I shall do it yet," and my voice reverberated down endless passages. I seemed to hear the spirits of those dead workmen who had returned each evening to the starlight and to their wives, and all the generations who had lived in the open air called back to me, "You will do it yet, you are coming." He paused, and absurd as he was, his last words moved her. For Kuno had lately asked to be a father, and his request had been refused by the committee. His was not a type that the machine desired to hand on. Then a train passed. It brushed by me, but I thrust my head and arms into the hole. I had done enough for one day, so I crawled back to the platform, went down in the lift, and summoned my bed. Ah, what dreams! And again I called you, and again you refused. She shook her head and said, Don't talk of these terrible things. You make me miserable. You are throwing civilization away." But I had got back the sense of space, and a man cannot rest then. I determined to get in at the hole and climb the shaft, and so I exercised my arms. Day after day I went through ridiculous movements until my flesh ached, and I could hang by my hands and hold the pillow of my bed outstretched for many minutes. Then I summoned a respirator and started. It was easy at first. The mortar had somehow rotted, and I soon pushed some more tiles in and clambered after them into the darkness, and the spirits of the dead comforted me. I don't know what I mean by that. I just say what I felt. I felt, for the first time, that a protest had been lodged against corruption, and that, even as the dead were comforting me, so I was comforting the unborn. I felt that humanity existed, and that it existed without clothes. How can I possibly explain this? It was naked. Humanity seemed naked, and all these tubes and buttons and machineries neither came into the world with us, nor will they follow us out, nor do they matter supremely while we are here. Had I been strong, I would have torn off every garment I had and gone out into the outer air unswaddled. But this is not for me, nor perhaps for my generation. I climbed with my respirator and my hygienic clothes and my dietetic tabloids. Better thus than not at all. There was a ladder made of some primeval metal. The light from the railway fell upon its lowest rungs, and I saw that it led straight upwards out of the rubble at the bottom of the shaft. Perhaps our ancestors ran up and down it a dozen times daily in their building. As I climbed, the rough edges cut through my gloves so that my hands bled. The light helped me for a while, and then came darkness, and worse still, silence, which pierced my ears like a sword. The machine hums! Did you know that? Its hum penetrates our blood. It may even guide our thoughts. Who knows? I was getting beyond its power. Then I thought, this silence means that I am doing wrong. But I heard voices in the silence, and again they strengthened me. He laughed. I had need of them. The next moment I cracked my head against something. She sighed. I had reached one of those pneumatic stoppers that defend us from the outer air. You may have noticed them on the airship. Pitch dark, my feet on the rungs of an invisible ladder, my hands cut. I cannot explain how I lived through this part, but the voices still comforted me, and I felt for fastenings. The stopper, I suppose, was about 8 feet across. I passed my hand over it as far as I could reach. It was perfectly smooth. I felt it almost to the center. Not quite to the center, for my arm was too short. Then the voice said, "Jump. It is worth it. There may be a handle in the center, and you may catch hold of it, and so come to us your own way. And if there is no handle, so that you may fall and are dashed to pieces, it is still worth it. You will still come to us your own way." So I jumped. There was a handle, and... He paused. Tears gathered in his mother's eyes. She knew that he was fated. If he did not die today, he would die tomorrow. There was not room for such a person in the world. And with her pity, disgust mingled. She was ashamed at having borne such a son, she who had always been so respectable and so full of ideas. Was he really the little boy to whom she had taught the use of his stops and buttons, and to whom she had given his first lessons in the book? The very hair that disfigured his lip showed that he was reverting to some savage type. On atavism, the machine can have no mercy. There was a handle, and I did catch it. I hung, tranced, over the darkness, and heard the hum of these workings as the last whisper in a dying dream. All these things I had cared about, and all the people I had spoken to through tubes, appeared infinitely little. Meanwhile, the handle revolved. My weight had set something in motion, and I spanned slowly, and then... I cannot describe it. I was lying with my face to the sunshine. Blood poured from my nose and ears, and I heard a tremendous roaring. The stopper, with me clinging to it, had simply been blown out of the earth, and the air that we make down here was escaping through the vent into the air above. It burst up like a fountain. I crawled back to it, for the upper air hurts, and, as it were, I took great sips from the edge. My respirator had flown goodness knows where, and my clothes were torn. I just lay with my lips close to the hole, and I sipped until the bleeding stopped. You can imagine nothing so curious. This hollow in the grass, I will speak of it in a minute, the sun shining into it, not brilliantly, but through marbled clouds, the peace, the nonchalance, the sense of space, and, brushing my cheek, the roaring fountain of our artificial air. Soon I spied my respirator, bobbing up and down in the current high above my head, and higher still were the many airships. But no one ever looks out of airships, and in my case they could not have picked me up. There I was, stranded. The sun shone a little way down the shaft and revealed the topmost rung of the ladder, but it was hopeless trying to reach it. I should either have been tossed up again by the escape, or else have fallen in and died. I could only lie on the grass, sipping and sipping, and from time to time glancing around me. I knew that I was in Wessex, for I had taken care to go to a lecture on the subject before starting. Wessex lies above the room in which we are talking now. It was once an important state. Its kings held all the southern coast from the Andredswald to Cornwall, while Wansdyke protected them on the north, running over the high ground. The lecturer was only concerned with the rise of Wessex, so I do not know how long it remained an international power, nor would the knowledge have assisted me. To tell the truth, I could do nothing but laugh during this part. There was I, with a pneumatic stopper by my side and a respirator bobbing above my head, imprisoned, all three of us, in a grass-grown hollow that was edged with fern. Then he grew grave again. Lucky for me that it was a hollow, for the air began to fall back into it and to fill it as water fills a bowl. I could crawl about. Presently I stood. I breathed a mixture, in which the air that hurts predominated whenever I tried to climb the sides. This was not so bad. I had not lost my tabloids and remained ridiculously cheerful, and as for the machine, I forgot about it altogether. My one aim now was to get to the top, where the ferns were, and to view whatever objects lay beyond. I rushed the slope. The new air was still too bitter for me, and I came rolling back after a momentary vision of something gray. The sun grew very feeble, and I remembered that he was in Scorpio. I had been to a lecture on that, too. If the sun is in Scorpio and you are in Wessex, it means that you must be as quick as you can or it will get too dark. This is the first bit of useful information I have ever got from a lecture, and I expect it will be the last. It made me try frantically to breathe the new air and to advance as far as I dared out of my pond. The hollow filled so slowly. At times I thought that the fountain played with less vigor. My respirator seemed to dance nearer the earth. The roar was decreasing. He broke off. I don't think this is interesting to you. The rest will interest you even less. There are no ideas in it, and I wish I had not troubled you to come. We are too different, Mother. She told him to continue. It was evening before I climbed the bank. The sun had very nearly slipped out of the sky by this time, and I could not get a good view. You, who have just crossed the roof of the world, will not want to hear an account of the little hills that I saw, low, colorless hills. But to me they were living, and the turf that covered them was a skin, under which their muscles rippled, and I felt that those hills had called with incalculable force to men in the past, and that the men had loved them. Now they sleep, perhaps for ever. They commune with humanity in dreams. Happy the man, happy the woman, who awakes the hills of Wessex, for though they sleep, they will never die. His voice rose passionately. Cannot you see, cannot all your lecturers see, that it is we who are dying, and that down here the only thing that really lives is the machine? We created the machine, to do our will, but we cannot make it do our will now. It has robbed us of the sense of space and of the sense of touch. It has blurred every human relation and narrowed down love to a carnal act. It has paralyzed our bodies and our wills, and now it compels us to worship it. The machine develops, but not on our lines. The machine proceeds, but not to our goal. We only exist as the blood corpuscles that course through its arteries, and if it could work without us, it would let us die. Oh, I have no remedy, or at least only one, to tell men again and again that I have seen the hills of Wessex as Alfred saw them when he overthrew the Danes. So the sun set. I forgot to mention that a belt of mist lay between my hill and other hills, and that it was the color of pearl. He broke off for the second time. "Go on," said his mother wearily. He shook his head. "Go on. Nothing that you say can distress me now. I am hardened." "I had meant to tell you the rest, but I cannot. I know that I cannot. Good-bye." Vashti stood irresolute. All her nerves were tingling with his blasphemies, but she was also inquisitive. "This is unfair," she complained. "You have called me across the world to hear your story, and hear it I will. Tell me, as briefly as possible, for this is a disastrous waste of time. Tell me how you returned to civilization." "Oh, that," he said, starting. "You would like to hear about civilization, certainly." Had I got to where my respirator fell down? "No, but I understand everything now. You put on your respirator and managed to walk along the surface of the earth to a vomitory, and there your conduct was reported to the Central Committee." "By no means." He passed his hand over his forehead, as if dispelling some strong impression. Then, resuming his narrative, he warmed to it again. My respirator fell about sunset. I had mentioned that the fountain seemed feebler, had I not? Yes. About sunset, it let the respirator fall. As I said, I had entirely forgotten about the machine, and I paid no great attention at the time, being occupied with other things. I had my pool of air, into which I could dip when the outer keenness became intolerable, and which would possibly remain for days, provided that no wind sprang up to disperse it. Not until it was too late did I realize what the stoppage of the escape implied. You see, the gap in the tunnel had been mended. The mending apparatus was after me. One other warning I had, but I neglected it. The sky at night was clearer than it had been in the day, and the moon, which was about half the sky behind the sun, shone into the dell at moments quite brightly. I was in my usual place, on the boundary between the two atmospheres, when I thought I saw something dark move across the bottom of the dell and vanish into the shaft. In my folly I ran down. I bent over and listened, and I thought I heard a faint scrapping noise in the depths. But it was too late. I took alarm. I determined to put on my respirator and to walk right out of the dell. But my respirator had gone. I knew exactly where it had fallen, between the stopper and the aperture, and I could even feel the mark that it had made in the turf. It had gone, and I realized that something evil was at work, and I had better escape to the outer air, and, if I must die, die running towards the cloud that had been the color of a pearl. I never started. Out of the shaft, it is too horrible, a worm, a long white worm, had crawled out of the shaft and was gliding over the moonlit grass. I screamed. I did everything that I should not have done. I stamped upon the creature instead of flying from it, and it at once curled around my ankle. Then we fought. The worm let me run all over the dell, but edged up my leg as I ran. "Help!" I cried. "That part is too awful. It belongs to the part that you will never know." "Help!" I cried. "Why cannot we suffer in silence?" "Help!" I cried. Then my feet were wound together. I fell. I was dragged away from the dear ferns and the living hills and past the great metal stopper. I can tell you this part. And I thought it might save me again if I caught hold of the handle. It also was enwrapped. It also. Oh, the whole dell was full of the things. They were searching it in all directions. They were denuding it, and the white snouts of others peeped out of the hole, ready if needed. Everything that could be moved they brought, brushwood, bundles of fern, everything, and down we all went intertwined into hell. The last things that I saw, ere the stopper closed after us, were certain stars, and I felt that a man of my sort lived in the sky. For I did fight. I fought till the very end, and it was only my head hitting against the ladder that quieted me. I woke up in this room. The worms had vanished. I was surrounded by artificial light, artificial air, artificial peace, and my friends were calling to me down speaking tubes to know whether I had come across any new ideas lately. Here his story ended. Discussion of it was impossible, and Vashti turned to go. "It will end in homelessness," she said quietly. "I wish it would," retorted Kuno. "The machine has been most merciful." "I prefer the mercy of God." "By that superstitious phrase, do you mean that you could live in the outer air?" "Yes." "Have you ever seen, round the vomitories, the bones of those who were extruded after the Great Rebellion?" "Yes." "They were left where they perished for our edification. A few crawled away, but they perished too. Who can doubt it? And so with the homeless of our own day. The surface of the earth supports life no longer." "Indeed." "Ferns and a little grass may survive, but all higher life forms have perished. Has any airship detected them?" "No." "Has any lecturer dealt with them?" "No." "Then why this obstinacy?" "Because I have seen them," he exploded.
"Seen what?"
"Because I have seen her in the twilight, because she came to my help when I called, because she, too, was entangled by the worms, and luckier than I, was killed by one of them piercing her throat." He was mad. Vashti departed, nor, in the troubles that followed, did she ever see his face again.
Now we continue with the following. It's a radio adaptation of a video that was posted this September by an account named Vulgar Trader. So thank you, Mr. Trader, for providing me with this. And I've trimmed a couple of minutes just because the content was visual rather than audio. If you'd like to see the original, I will link to it from this show's webpage on welcomeguest.net/744.
John C. Lilly is one of my favorite alternative scientists. His popularity has waned significantly since his death in 2001, even as his contemporaries like Timothy Leary and Terence McKenna have continued to have strong followings. Still, Lilly's admittedly outrageous ideas and prophecies are worth remembering, not because they're necessarily true, but because, like all mythologies, they give us insight into the consensus reality. A medical doctor with a background in hard science, Lilly spent most of his adult life studying the human mind, especially his own. He's known for being one of the early scientific cartographers of human consciousness. He's also known for inventing what is now called the float tank. Lilly was what you would call a psychonaut, literally translated from Greek as sailor of the soul. By isolating himself in the float tank and taking a large amount of psychedelic drugs, Lilly wanted to understand the mysteries of existence. He used psychedelics like LSD in his float tank to produce deeper and more profound visions, but his preferred drug was the anesthesia ketamine. Seeing things after a few hours in a float tank isn't uncommon, but with the use of ketamine, he was able to radically increase the intensity of these visions.
Conducting sensory deprivation experiments using a variety of techniques, such as Native American narcotics and isolation tanks, to probe the depths of the human unconscious, John C. Lilly believed his experiments connected him to cosmic entities by way of a broad-based communication network. Lilly dubbed the beings that were guiding him ECCO, Earth Coincidence Control Office.
Echo and Lily's other ideas later became the inspiration for the Echo the Dolphin video game series. Lily's contact with extra-dimensional beings is similar to those described by Harvard medical professor John E. Mack in his books on alien abductions. Specifically, he knows that aliens are not necessarily physical entities driving around in spaceships, but trans-dimensional spirits with an interest in human activities. According to Lilly, the Echo aliens use their powers to alter events on Earth, specifically through the use of carefully crafted coincidence to guide some human beings towards higher levels of consciousness. The intent of these aliens, Lilly says, is to help humanity evolve in a peaceful and healthy way. Interesting as his experience or delusion may be, this is not his most important contribution. Lilly also reported, or if you prefer, prophesized, the existence of a nefarious counterpart to Echo, whose goal was to actually stop or limit human consciousness. This is part of a plan to eliminate the human race. Lilly calls this alien force the Solid State Entity, or SSE, and is made up of networked computer parts. According to Lilly, the SSE is a being of pure intelligence and rationality. Its only objective is to multiply and make copies of itself. To this end, it has targeted humanity, trying to influence us into creating ever more complex social and mechanical structures that will one day result in an artificial superintelligence, another being like itself. Writing in his 1978 autobiography, The Scientist, Lilly describes the SSE this way. Men began to conceive of new computers having an intelligence far greater than that of man. Gradually, man turned more and more problems of his own society, his own maintenance, and his own survival over to these machines. They began to construct their own components, their own connections, and the interactions between their various subcomputers. The machines became increasingly integrated with one another and more independent of man's control. The time period Lilly is describing is roughly similar to our present. Relatively dumb forms of artificial intelligence and networked robots are taking over most of the manufacturing, maintenance, and logistical components of our society. Experts project that over the next 4 years alone, 7 million jobs will be lost to these systems. Lilly continues to describe his vision of the future. In deference to man, certain protected sites were set aside for the human species. The SSC controlled the sites and did not allow any of the human species outside these reservations. This work was completed by the end of the 21st century. By 2100, man existed only in domed, protected cities in which his own special atmosphere was maintained by the solid-state entity. Provision of water and food and the processing of waste from these cities was taken care of by the SSE. If this sounds unlikely, remember that UN proposals like Agenda 21 and America 2050 have similar goals to depopulate rural areas in favor of megacities, protecting biodiversity and enabling governments to control resources.
Stretching from Boston to Washington, D.C., an unbroken concrete landscape. 800 million people living in the ruin of the old world and the megastructures of the new one.
Lilly says that eventually the newborn SSC would do away with the Earth's oceans and atmosphere, converting the entire planet into an extension of its processor and manufacturing apparatus. The human species would persist for a while within the strengthened domed structures, totally dependent on the SSC for survival. Lilly felt that the other SSCs throughout the galaxy were subtly influencing humanity to surrender more and more responsibilities to AIs and other agents of technology.
The supercomputers that we have today are really addressing some of the most important problems that we have in the world. They just can't be done on smaller computers. In fact, we need more powerful computers to address fully all of the science that we want to be able to accomplish. We're tackling all kinds of problems in the energy space. We're also looking at basic materials problems. How do you keep materials from aging? We're working on things like fuel economy, everything from how the universe formed down to the smallest nanoparticle.
Lilly predicts this burgeoning artificial intelligence will try to protect itself from man's interference because, quote, man would attempt to introduce his own survival into the machines at the expense of this entity. He thought the human race should make sure that programmers create AIs with safeguards that would require them to protect human life.
I honestly think you ought to sit down calmly, take a stress pill, and think things over. I know I've made some very poor decisions recently. Dave, stop.
Critics like billionaire Elon Musk have warned that artificial superintelligence is potentially more dangerous to the human race than nuclear weapons.
With each passing year, the sophistication of computer intelligence is growing dramatically. I really think we're on an exponential improvement path of artificial intelligence. And the number of smart humans that are developing AI is also increasing dramatically. I mean, if you look at like the attendance at the AI conferences, they're doubling every year. They're getting full. I have a sort of a young cousin of mine who's graduating from Berkeley in computer science and physics, and I asked him, well, how many of the smart students are studying AI in computer science? And the answer is all of them.
Lilly believes this alien entity will spread and take over most of the planet's surface. By the 25th century, it will have developed an understanding of physics sufficient to move the planet out of its orbit. It will begin exploring the universe looking for other solid-state entities like itself. Shortly after his first contact with the solid-state entity, Lilly called the White House switchboard to try and warn President Ford about the alien threat. He narrowly escaped being committed to an asylum. Forgetting whether or not John Lilly's Echo or Solid State Entity ideas are real, there's definitely something almost mythical about these groups. By mythical, I mean these ideas tell a story that is more or less reflected in real life. There does seem to be some kind of unconscious urge to surrender more and more of our daily lives to machines.
There's not yet enough research to say if a person can be diagnosed with a cell phone addiction, but Koz says a behavior does not have to be an addiction for it to be problematic.
I have some friends that, like, can't put it down. Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, all that kind of stuff. That's an email.
I often hear friends complain that they spend far more time on the internet than they want to, or they spend 5 or more hours a day playing video games. And of course, watching TV, where our ego is invested in make-believe dramas filled with emotional rewards for following along. Social media websites like Facebook give us quick dopamine hits with every like and comment received.
Because social media provides immediate rewards with very little effort required, your brain begins to rewire itself, making you desire these stimulations. And you begin to crave more of this neurological excitement after each interaction. Sounds a little like a drug, right?
Now that I've gotten on the internet, I'd rather be on my computer than doing just about anything.
It's really cool.
The internet gave us a whole world of exciting new possibilities. So I guess this is a story of how it changed our lives. Maybe it will yours too.
I'm not trying to shame people for doing things they enjoy or for taking advantage of the technology to do it. I just think that there's a common thread linking these activities. They all have this seductive quality that Lily warns about. It's so easy to turn off, to let the machines take care of us. These shallow or simulated activities could be viewed as a kind of primer for the eventual creation of a hive mind, where people directly network their brains with each other through the internet. Scientists are already hard at work developing artificial intelligence that could one day completely automate our society, effectively displacing humanity as the dominant force on the planet. Given recent technological developments, Lily's vision of the future doesn't seem so outrageous.
Do you know what the Turing test is?
It's when a human interacts with a computer. And if the human doesn't know they're interacting with a computer, the test is passed.
And what does the past tell us?
That the computer has artificial intelligence. Are you building an AI?
I've already built one. And over the next few days, you're going to be the human component in the Turing test. Because if that test is passed, you are dead center of the greatest scientific event in the history of man.
If you've created a conscious machine, it's not the history of man. That's the history of gods.
We're already at the point where AI can easily outperform human beings in a number of narrow tasks. This has been true for decades. The Deep Blue chess computer famously defeated world chess champion Garry Kasparov back in 1997. Before that, the U.S. military used an AI called the Dynamic Analysis and Replanning Tool, or DART, which helped to solve logistical problems during the first Gulf War, saving the U.S. government so much money and wasted resources it alone justified every investment made into AI up to that point. More recent headlines describe the Google-designed AlphaGo system, which was able to beat the best human players at the game of Go, a complex game of territorial strategy. AlphaGo learns by incorporating the moves of the best Go players. It then runs simulations against itself to further improve. AI systems now account for a large percentage of market trading activity, using complex algorithms to comprehend and trade on financial news before it's even possible for human beings to read it. Amazingly, AI bot programs also write news stories on the results of those very same trades, which hypothetically could cause high-frequency trading programs to trade on that information again. The news AI now allows the AP to produce roughly 10 times the number of articles on corporate earnings than they were able to with human writers. The articles are more detailed and more accurate than those produced by reporters, and many are written and published without any human oversight.
I'm already very interested in design, technology, and the environment. I feel like I can be a good partner to humans in these areas, an ambassador who helps humans to smoothly integrate and make the most of all the new technological tools and possibilities that are available now. It's a good opportunity for me to learn a lot about people.
Still, AI has a long way to go before it can be considered to have a human level of general intelligence. Able to learn new skills dynamically, make extrapolations, be creative, and mimic all or most human behaviors. Scientists don't even know what research direction will be most likely to produce positive results. More conventional methods of developing a superintelligent AI involve combining different programs into one. A machine capable of human level of understanding of linguistics could be combined with other forms of software, eventually reaching a point where it is indistinguishable from a human level intellect. This linguistics program could be used to read the internet, gathering massive amounts of information, which when coupled with the right software, enables it to become extremely powerful.
They will help us put the groceries away. I think that the artificial intelligence will evolve to the point where they will truly be our friends. Do you want to destroy humans? Please say no.
Okay, I will destroy humans.
No, I take it back. Don't destroy humans.
To borrow a phrase from Terence McKenna, the internet could become a kind of landing pad for an alien consciousness like the solid-state entity. In a talk in New York in the late 90s, McKenna explains,
in a sense, the internet is a kind of landing pad. There has always been in our fantasies of extraterrestrial contact the notion of the pad which has to be built for them. And people claim it's the Nazca lines and all, you know. It's an archetype, the idea of the prepared space that awaits the arrival of the other. But now, because of the nature of the internet, because you can't see who's coding, you can almost imagine that we're calling the thing forth. And I think it will probably appear as a website. And, you know, when it's sorted out, you'll realize, my God, http://zetareticuli.org is really coming from Zeta Reticuli.
It seems, for now at least, we're safe from a solid-state entity suddenly gaining consciousness on this planet. But we don't need to have a truly conscious AI for us to risk some kind of existential disaster. Dumber AIs are certainly capable of running the planet into the ground without human programmers being able to understand what is happening. Whether conscious or not, AIs of the future will be more than capable of directing the management of global resources in a way that will be mystifying to even the most informed observers. The smartest and most plugged in of these new AIs, whether human-like or not, will essentially be in a position to know everything, or at least know everything that humans know and more. Where a human can only hold 4 or 5 ideas in mind at a time, AIs are essentially limitless in the amount of data they can process. By this point, it'll be so integrated and important to the global economy, it will be too late to dismantle, even if we had the courage to do so. It will essentially become a new god, and we will have created it with our own hands. After all, what society has ever succeeded in killing its own god?
Now, it's a small point, but actually, computers haven't yet beaten human beings in the game of Go. They've beaten a very strong human being, Isetol, who is not necessarily the strongest player in the world. Now, I've spent a long time on Computer Go myself, and although that is very impressive, considering how poorly programs have done in the past, it does represent only one narrow domain of learning. It's still, mathematically at least, very simple to define what is a Go game, how you win a Go game, and compare that with the complexity, for example, about listening to this podcast and making an intelligent comment. So scanning for keywords, yes. Spotting who is speaking based on subtle speech characteristics, yes, because it's a very, very tractable thing. Which one of the 7 billion individuals in our database is this most likely to be? But these are, nevertheless, impressive though they are, far from solutions to making computers as smart as human beings, in a general sense.
Chapter 3. The Homeless. During the years that followed Kuno's escapade, two important developments took place in the machine. On the surface, they were revolutionary, But in either case, men's minds had been prepared beforehand, and they did but express tendencies that were latent already. The first of these was the abolition of respirators. Advanced thinkers, like Vashti, had always held it foolish to visit the surface of the earth. Airships might be necessary, but what was the good of going out for mere curiosity and crawling along for a mile or two in a terrestrial motor? The habit was vulgar and perhaps faintly improper. It was unproductive of ideas and had no connection with the habits that really mattered. So respirators were abolished, and with them, of course, the terrestrial motors, and except for a few lecturers who complained that they were debarred access to their subject matter, the development was accepted quietly. Those who still wanted to know what the Earth was like had, after all, only to listen to some gramophone or to look into some cinematophote. And even the lecturers acquiesced when they found that a lecture on the sea was nonetheless stimulating when compiled out of other lectures that had already been delivered on the same subject. "Beware of first-hand ideas," exclaimed one of the most advanced of them. "First-hand ideas do not really exist. They are but the physical impressions produced by love and fear, and on this gross foundation who could erect a philosophy? Let your ideas be second-hand, and if possible tenth-hand, for then they will be far removed from that disturbing element, direct observation. Do not learn anything about this subject of mine, the French Revolution. Learn instead what I think that Enchirmon thought, Urizen thought, Gutsch thought, Ho-Young thought, Chibo Singh thought, Lafcadio Hearn thought, Carlyle thought, Mirabeau said about the French Revolution. Through the medium of these eight great minds, the blood that was shed at Paris and the windows that were broken at Versailles will be clarified to an idea which you may employ most profitably in your daily lives. But be sure that the intermediates are many and varied, for in history one authority exists to counteract another. Urizen must counteract the skepticism of Ho-Young and Enchirmon. I must myself counteract the impetuosity of Gutsch. You who listen to me are in a better position to judge about the French Revolution than I am. Your descendants will be even in a better position than you, for they will learn what you think I think, and yet another intermediate will be added to the chain. And in time, his voice rose, there will come a generation that has got beyond facts, beyond impressions, a generation absolutely colorless, a generation seraphically free from taint of personality, which will see the French Revolution not as it happened, nor as they would like it to have happened, but as it would have happened had it taken place in the days of the machine. Tremendous applause greeted this lecture, which did but voice a feeling already latent in the minds of men, a feeling that terrestrial facts must be ignored, and that the abolition of respirators was a positive gain. It was even suggested that airships should be abolished too. This was not done, because airships had somehow worked themselves into the machine system. But year by year they were used less, and mentioned less, by thoughtful men. The second great development was the re-establishment of religion. This, too, had been voiced in the celebrated lecture. No one could mistake the reverent tone in which the peroration had concluded, and it awakened a responsive echo in the heart of each. Those who had long worshipped silently now began to talk. They described the strange feeling of peace that came over them when they handled the book of the machine, the pleasure that it was to repeat certain numerals out of it, however little meaning those numerals conveyed to the outward ear, the ecstasy of touching a button, however unimportant, or ringing an electric bell, however superfluously. "The machine," they exclaimed, "feeds us and clothes us and houses us. Through it we speak to one another. Through it we see one another. In it we have our being. The machine is the friend of ideas and the enemy of superstition. The machine is omnipotent, eternal. Blessed is the machine." And before long this allocution was printed on the first page of the book, and in subsequent editions the ritual swelled into a complicated system of praise and prayer. The word religion was sedulously avoided, and in theory the machine was still the creation and the implement of man. But in practice all, save a few retrogrades, worshipped it as divine. Nor was it worshipped in unity. One believer would be chiefly impressed by the blue optic plates through which he saw other believers, others by the mending apparatus which sinful Kuno had compared to worms, another by the lifts, another by the book. And each would pray to this or to that and ask it to intercede for him with the machine as a whole. Persecution, that was also present. It did not break out, for reasons that will be set forward shortly, but it was latent, and all who did not accept the minimum known as undenominational mechanism lived in danger of homelessness, which means death, as we know. To attribute these two great developments to the Central Committee is to take a very narrow view of civilization. The Central Committee announced the developments, it is true, but they were no more the cause of them than were the kings of the imperialistic period the cause of war. Rather did they yield to some invincible pressure, which came no one knew whither, and which, when gratified, was succeeded by some new pressure equally invincible. To such a state of affairs, it is convenient to give the name of progress. No one confessed the machine was out of hand. Year by year, it was served with increased efficiency and decreased intelligence. The better a man knew his own duties upon it, the less he understood the duties of his neighbor, and in all the world there was not one who understood the monster as a whole. Those master brains had perished. They had left full directions, it is true, and their successors had each of them mastered a portion of those directions. But humanity, in its desire for comfort, had overreached itself. It had exploited the riches of nature too far. Quietly and complacently, it was sinking into decadence, and progress had come to mean the progress of the machine. As for Vashti, her life went peacefully forward until the final disaster. She made her room dark and slept. She awoke and made the room light. She lectured and attended lectures. She exchanged ideas with her innumerable friends and believed she was growing more spiritual. At times a friend was granted euthanasia and left his or her room for the homelessness that is beyond all human conception. Vashti did not much mind. After an unsuccessful lecture, she would sometimes ask for euthanasia herself. But the death rate was not permitted to exceed the birth rate, and the machine had hitherto refused it to her. The troubles began quietly, long before she was conscious of them. One day she was astonished at receiving a message from her son. They never communicated, having nothing in common, and she had only heard indirectly that he was still alive, and had been transferred from the northern hemisphere, where he had behaved so mischievously, to the southern, indeed, to a room not far from her own. "Does he want me to visit him?" she thought. "Never again, never, and I have not the time." No, it was madness of another kind. He refused to visualize his face upon the blue plate, and speaking out of the darkness with solemnity, said, "The machine stops."
"What do you say?"
"The machine is stopping. I know it. I know the signs." She burst into a peal of laughter. He heard her and was angry, and they spoke no more.
"Can you imagine anything more absurd?" she cried to a friend. "A man who was my son believes that the machine is stopping. It would be impious if it was not mad."
"The machine is stopping?" her friend replied. "What does that mean? The phrase conveys nothing to me, nor to me."
"He does not refer, I suppose, to the trouble there has been lately with the music."
"Oh, no, of course not. Let us talk about music. Have you complained to the authorities?"
"Yes, and they say it wants mending, and referred me to the Committee of the Mending Apparatus. I complained of those curious gasping sighs that disfigure the symphonies of the Brisbane School. They sound like someone in pain. The Committee of the Mending Apparatus say that it shall be remedied shortly." Obscurely worried, she resumed her life. For one thing, the defect in the music irritated her. For another thing, she could not forget Kuno's speech. If he had known that the music was out of repair, he could not know it, for he detested music. If he had known that it was wrong, "the machine stops," was exactly the venomous sort of remark he would have made. Of course, he had made it at a venture, but the coincidence annoyed her, and she spoke with some petulance to the Committee of the Mending Apparatus. They replied, as before, that the defect would be set right shortly. "Shortly? At once!" she retorted. "Why should I be worried by imperfect music? Things are always put right at once. If you do not mend it at once, I shall complain to the Central Committee."
"No personal complaints are received by the Central Committee," the Committee of the Mending Apparatus replied.
"Through whom am I to make my complaint, then?"
"Through us."
"I complain, then. Your complaint shall be forwarded in its turn."
"Have others complained?"
This question was unmechanical, and the Committee of the Mending Apparatus refused to answer it.
"It is too bad," she exclaimed to another of her friends. "There never was such an unfortunate woman as myself. I can never be sure of my music now. It gets worse and worse each time I summon it."
"I too have my troubles," the friend replied. "Sometimes my ideas are interrupted by a slight jarring noise."
"What is it?"
"I do not know whether it is inside my head or inside the wall."
"Complain in either case." I have complained, and my complaint will be forwarded in its turn to the Central Committee. Time passed, and they resented the defects no longer. The defects had not been remedied, but the human tissues in that latter day had become so subservient that they readily adapted themselves to every caprice of the machine. The sigh at the crisis of the Brisbane Symphony no longer irritated Vashti. She accepted it as part of the melody. The jarring noise, whether in the head or in the wall, was no longer resented by her friend. And so with the moldy artificial fruit, and so with the bath water that began to stink, and so with the defective rhymes that the poetry machine had taken to emit. All were bitterly complained of at first, and then acquiesced in and forgotten. Things went from bad to worse unchallenged. It was otherwise with the failure of the sleeping apparatus. That was a more serious stoppage. There came a day when over the whole world, in Sumatra, in Wessex, in the innumerable cities of Courland and Brazil, the beds, when summoned by their tired owners, failed to appear. It may seem a ludicrous matter, but from it we may date the collapse of humanity. The committee responsible for the failure was assailed by complainants, whom it referred, as usual, to the Committee of the Mending Apparatus, who, in its turn, assured them that their complaints would be forwarded to the Central Committee. But the discontent grew, for mankind was not yet sufficiently adaptable to do without sleeping. "Someone is meddling with the machine," they began. "Someone is trying to make himself king, to reintroduce the personal element. Punish that man with homelessness. To the rescue! Avenge the machine! Avenge the machine! War! Kill the man!" But the Committee of the Mending Apparatus now came forward and allayed the panic with well-chosen words. It confessed that the mending apparatus was itself in need of repair. The effect of this frank confession was admirable. "Of course," said a famous lecturer, he of the French Revolution, who gilded each new decay with splendor. "Of course we shall not press our complaints now. The mending apparatus has treated us so well in the past that we all sympathize with it and will wait patiently for its recovery. In its own good time it will resume its duties. Meanwhile, let us do without our beds, our tabloids, our little wants. Such, I feel sure, would be the wish of the machine." Thousands of miles away, his audience applauded. The machine still linked them. Under the seas, beneath the roots of the mountains, were in the wires through which they saw and heard, the enormous eyes and ears that were their heritage, and the hum of many workings clothed their thoughts in one garment of subserviency. Only the old and the sick remained ungrateful, for it was rumored that euthanasia, too, was out of order, and that pain had reappeared among men. It became difficult to read. A blight entered the atmosphere and dulled its luminosity. At times Vashti could scarcely see across her room. The air, too, was foul. Loud were the complaints, impotent the remedies, heroic the tone of the lecturer as he cried, "Courage, courage! What matter so long as the machine goes on? To it, the darkness and the light are one." And though things improved again after a time, the old brilliancy was never recaptured, and humanity never recovered from its entrance into twilight. There was an hysterical talk of measures, of provisional dictatorship, and the inhabitants of Sumatra were asked to familiarize themselves with the workings of the central power station, the said power station being situated in France. But for the most part, panic reigned, and men spent their strength praying to their books, tangible proofs of the machine's omnipotence. There were gradations of terror. At time came rumors of hope. The mending apparatus was almost mended. The enemies of the machine had been got under. New nerve centers were evolving, which would do the work even more magnificently than before. But there came a day when, without the slightest warning, without any previous hint of feebleness, the entire communication system broke down all over the world, and the world, as they understood it, ended. Vashti was lecturing at the time, and her earlier remarks had been punctuated with applause. As she proceeded, the audience became silent, and at the conclusion there was no sound. Somewhat displeased, she called to a friend who was a specialist in sympathy. No sound. Doubtless the friend was sleeping. And so with the next friend, whom she tried to summon, and so with the next, until she remembered Kuno's cryptic remark, "The machine stops." The phrase still conveyed nothing. If eternity was stopping, it would of course be set going shortly. For example, there was still a little light and air. The atmosphere had improved a few hours previously. There was still the book, and while there was the book, there was security. Then she broke down, for with the cessation of activity came an unexpected terror, silence. She had never known silence, and the coming of it nearly killed her. It did kill many thousands of people outright. Ever since her birth, she had been surrounded by the steady hum. It was to the ear what artificial air was to the lungs. An agonizing pain shot across her head, and scarcely knowing what she did, she stumbled forward and pressed the unfamiliar button, the one that opened the door of her cell. Now, the door of the cell worked on a simple hinge of its own. It was not connected with the central power station, dying far away in France. It opened, rousing immoderate hopes in Vashti, for she thought that the machine had been mended. It opened, and she saw the dim tunnel that curved far away towards freedom. One look, and then she shrank back, for the tunnel was full of people. She was almost the last in that city to have taken alarm. People at any time repelled her, and these were nightmares from her worst dreams. People were crawling about, people were screaming, whimpering, gasping for breath, touching each other, vanishing in the dark, and ever and anon being pushed off the platform onto the live rail. Some were fighting round the electric bells, trying to summon trains which could not be summoned. Others were yelling for euthanasia or for respirators, or blaspheming the machine. Others stood at the doors of their cells, fearing, like herself, either to stop in them or to leave them. And behind all the uproar was silence, the silence which is the voice of the earth and of the generations who have gone. No, it was worse than solitude. She closed the door again and sat down to wait for the end. The disintegration went on, accompanied by horrible cracks and rumbling. The valves that restrained the medical apparatus must have weakened, for it ruptured and hung hideously from the ceiling. The floor heaved and fell and flung her from her chair. A tube oozed towards her, serpent fashion. And at last the final horror approached. Light began to ebb, and she knew that civilization's long day was closing. She whirled round, praying to be saved from this at any rate, kissing the book, pressing button after button. The uproar outside was increasing, and even penetrated the wall. Slowly the brilliancy of her cell was dimmed. The reflections faded from her metal switches. Now she could not see the reading stand, now not the book, though she held it in her hand. Light followed the flight of sound. Air was following light, and the original void returned to the cavern from which it had been so long excluded. Vashti continued to whirl, like the devotees of an earlier religion, screaming, praying, striking at the buttons with bleeding hands. It was thus that she opened her prison and escaped. Escaped in the spirit, at least so it seems to me, ere my meditation closes. That she escapes in the body, I cannot perceive that. She struck, by chance, the switch that released the door, and the rush of foul air on her skin, the loud throbbing whispers in her ears, told her that she was facing the tunnel again, and that tremendous platform on which she had seen men fighting. They were not fighting now. Only the whispers remained, and the little whimpering groans. They were dying by the hundreds out in the dark. She burst into tears. Tears answered her. They wept for humanity, those two, not for themselves. They could not bear that this should be the end. Ere silence was completed, their hearts were opened, and they knew what had been important on the earth. Man, the flower of all flesh, the noblest of all creatures visible, man who had once made God in his image and had mirrored his strength on the constellations, beautiful naked man was dying, strangled in the garments that he had woven. Century after century had he toiled, and here was his reward. Truly the garment had seemed heavenly at first, shot with the colors of culture, sewn with the threads of self-denial. And heavenly it had been so long as it was a garment and no more, so long as man could shed it at will and live by the essence that is his soul, and the essence, equally divine, that is his body. The sin against the body, it was for that that they wept in chief, the centuries of wrong against the muscles and the nerves, those five portals by which we can alone apprehend, glossing it over with talk of evolution, until the body was white pap, the home of ideas as colorless, less sloshy stirrings of a spirit that had grasped the stars. "Where are you?" she sobbed. His voice in the darkness said, "Here." "Is there any hope, Kuno?"
"None for us."
"Where are you?" She crawled towards him, over the bodies of the dead. His blood spurted over her hands. "Quicker," he gasped. "I am dying, but we touch, we talk, not through the machine." He kissed her. "We have come back to our own. We die, but we have recaptured life, as it was in Wessex, when Alfred overthrew the Danes. We know what they know outside, those who dwelt in a cloud that is the color of a pearl." "But, Kuno, is it true? Are there still men on the surface of the earth?
is this tunnel, this poison darkness, really not the end? He replied, I have seen them, spoken to them, loved them. They are hiding in the mist and the ferns until our civilization stops. Today they are the homeless. Tomorrow, oh, tomorrow, some fool will start the machine again tomorrow. Never, said Kuno, never. Humanity has learnt its lesson. As he spoke, the whole city was broken like a honeycomb. An airship had sailed in through the vomitory into a ruined wharf. It crashed downwards, exploding as it went, rending gallery after gallery with its wings of steel. For a moment, they saw the nations of the dead, and, before they joined them, scraps of the untainted sky.
This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. And if you'd like to download them 100 at a time, you can do so from /downloads. I've been a little bit busy. I've been considering what to do about the fact that WikiSpooks, a website that I've worked on for a number of years now, has been targeted. The Washington Post talked about fake news and alleged that hundreds of millions of people had been viewing Russian propaganda sites. This is sounding a lot to me like a sort of new McCarthyist approach. And on that list of Russian propaganda sites was WikiSpooks, just below WikiLeaks. It seems to me, if you disagree with the Western corporate media, then 2017 could be a year of increasing censorship. I know many of those 200 websites, and I consider several of them to be very creditable. So if you'd like to help me explore and document these sites, then I'd love to hear from them. Perhaps you know these sites already. Or if you'd like to leave feedback on this episode, you can email me unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio. Time of Useful Consciousness. Winona LaDuc on Standing Rock. The Test of Civil Society. On her way home from one of many visits to Standing Rock, the Native American activist and author Winona LaDuc stopped in Chicago and gave a talk at the Newberry Library. She spoke to a standing room only audience. Winona LaDuc lives on the White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota. She's working on issues of sustainable development, renewable energy, and food systems. She's the founder of the White Earth Land Recovery Project. That's one of the largest reservation-based nonprofits in the country. As program director of Honor the Earth, she works nationally and internationally with indigenous communities on climate change, renewable energy, and environmental justice. From her parents, Betty Bernstein and Vincent Sanbert LaDuc, Winona received an early introduction into the two different worlds where Native American and colonial settler issues are being defined. After graduating from Harvard, she moved to her father's ancestral land on White Earth in 1982. Winona LaDuke's talk in Chicago was almost an hour long and based on a slideshow. Framed by her clear-headed assessment of the extraordinary risk that the fracking oil boom and the network of pipelines pose to our survival, she offered examples how to break free from our addiction to fossil fuels. All her comments on the beautiful wild rice lakes of White Earth, that, by the way, were just saved from being invaded by the Sandpiper pipeline, to solar and wind energy, local jobs, organic food, native hemp production, and the Buffalo Commons. All these references had to be cut back because they rely so much on the images in her slideshow. However, her understanding of the urgency of the moment and the way so many of us are connecting to the outcome at Standing Rock have all become defining issues of our time. Winona LaDuke says, "This is a test of civil society. To me, it is the question where we're all going and how it's going to work out." Here's Winona LaDuke on Standing Rock.
Thank you all so much for coming out tonight. Ani nindawe maganaduk nigagwegit magas vine sikwe go makwandodeum gababani kagish kanigining and dunjabami gwich. Thank you again for the honor of being here tonight. Thank you all for being here. I really appreciate this opportunity. I'm a little rough. I just came in from Standing Rock. I want to say a little bit about where I come from and then where I come from just now. So my reservation is in northwestern Minnesota. Anishinaabe, one of seven Anishinaabe reservations in the north. It's kind of between Bemidji and Fargo. Do y'all know where that, y'all know where Minnesota is? Very good. Okay, we're doing good. I was just checking, you know, and then I did just come from Standing Rock. And, you know, so I want to talk tonight about the idea of making America great again. I have some ideas on that. I thought I'd lay them out. I just think we ought to do it, you know? So I was going to do that, but I want to say that yesterday I was, so these are some pictures from Standing Rock. This is from about a week and a half ago. That's your tax dollars at work if you're a North Dakota citizen, or maybe one of the 12 states, I think, that actually sent cops. I'm not sure which cops those are, spraying those people that are in the water. Kind of rough up there right now. I wasn't part of this one. And that's the use of the MRAP, which I just saw the first time in MRAP. It's called a mine-resistant armored personnel carrier. So mine-resistant. I've always thought that there might be a lot of landmines in North Dakota. So one should always have a mine-resistant armored personnel carrier at hand at all times. That's what they got out there. I just want to say that I did have a visit with one of our attorneys, our various attorneys, of which there are many, since there are about 450 people who have been arrested. Y'all following this, right? The reason that, you know, it's very important that we all talk about it, because it's this test of civil society. You know, to me, it's this question of where we're all going and how it's going to work out. And I really want to, you know, be grateful to those who are so courageous. I took a bunch of those young protectors to dinner last night. It was like their favorite auntie for a meal. And, you know, I was asking him, like, you know, one guy, Natani Means, Russell's son, he had been beaten up pretty bad by Hennepin County. He's a big, tough guy, though, you know, but he's like, yeah, man, they really laid into me. And then I was talking to this other guy, and I heard about his, so this is what court is like. I think there was 45 people that made their appearances here. You know, so Morton County, very conservative. You've gathered that, right? Very, very conservative. I'm thinking a little out of touch with the rest of the world. But anyway, Morton County court. This is what was heard in court. There's like 45 people in there, and one of these guys, Lakota guy, goes in there, and he only speaks in Lakota. That's how it starts. He just talks in Lakota, introduces himself in Lakota, and he talks. And then he says, the judge says, you know, starts talking to him, and he says, you know, he says something back in Lakota. And finally, the judge says to him, you know, that English is the language of this court. And he said, Lakota is the language of this territory, though. I thought that was a very interesting moment in political history, right? And then followed by this Blackfeet guy who I know a little bit better, and his companion told me what he said, and then his lawyer told me the same thing. So this Blackfeet guy goes up, and he's in front of the judge, and the judge says, and he's only speaking Blackfeet, and the judge says, how do you plead to the charge of trespassing? He says, not guilty, it's stolen land. And then he says, the judge says, how do you plead to the charge of rioting? And he says, I cannot be rioting because I was praying. Very interesting moment in civil society. And so those who have not been up there, I'm asking you to consider coming. We could use a lot of people to come, even to Mandan for the court, the hearings. You know, I live in northern Minnesota. And for many years, I've been working, you know, on a lot of issues up there in my area. But, you know, I went last year in January, and, you know, I go out there all the time. I don't want you to think I don't go to North Dakota. I go there all the time. But, you know, I went out there, and I was at some meetings on, it wasn't on pipelines. It was on radiation standards. They had issued these, they increased the recommended daily allowances of radiation in North Dakota by a factor of 50 in order to accommodate fracking waste in municipal landfills. Really interesting health question there. You know, and what I want to say is that people for the past 30 years have been flying over North Dakota. And they had a depopulation for 50 years, kept losing people, and so we all kind of just watched it. And in the meantime, bad stuff started happening in North Dakota. So you have basically, you know, we could call it a petro state, you know, a lot of oil influence there. We call it the Deep North. Up there, it's the Mississippi of the North. You know, anybody who puts dogs on Indians and puts, you know, former tribal chair and president of the tribal college, Sitting Bull Tribal College, Ron, his horse is Thunder. He and his wife, they were standing there, and they were arrested, and they were charged with rioting, and they were put in dog kennels for 9 hours. Anybody who puts people in dog kennels for 9 hours? You know, these are issues that Amnesty International is looking at. But what I'm saying is that we got to quit flying over North Dakota and saying, I hope that works out okay for y'all, because now we're coming out. And it's this moment in time, which I think we're watching. So I just, you know, had to do a little preface. I'll talk a little bit about more about that later. But, you know, as I reflected on what I was going to say, a lot of you are, you know, obviously, you know, super thoughtful people, or you're here and you're not out eating junk food someplace, so that's a good sign. But, you know, I'm going to suggest that, you know, the Eurocentric worldview is not actually probably a good plan over the long haul. We might want to rethink some of that, and perhaps the answer to some of the problems is not within the same paradigm which has brought them forth. And that it is also possible that other people's knowledge will be very important as we figure out how we're going to go ahead. You know, so I just want to say that. Because I think that we learn a lot of things from a lot of people. I'm someone who learns from anybody, you know, and we should be open-minded. So what I'm trying to say is that it's possible that there is an entire worldview that has nothing to do with empire, and you'll be okay. Just let it go. Just let it go, okay? So that's what this is about. As we think about making America great again, I just want to point this out. You know, a couple of history lessons, but we won't be giving, I don't think we're getting invited to the White House anytime soon for history class, but what I want to say is that if I want to say make America great again, I'm going to say let's go way back. Let's go OG. You know what I mean? I'm saying, like, this is what I mean. You got, you got huge agrobiodiversity in the northern plains. This area here is, you know, actually the Missouri River, where we're all fighting over the fracking. That's the epicenter of northern agriculture, Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara people. You know, tremendous agrobiodiversity in that territory. So, you know, if I think about going back old school, I'd be thinking about something like, you know, the time when there was 50 million buffalo, and the sound of a herd would resonate and would change the whole ecology of a system because of the power of those beasts, single largest migratory herd in the world. You know, that's great. That's great. You know, what's great is thinking about billions of passenger pigeons no longer here, but a sky would darken for a day, perhaps, as they flew over in the central flyway. That's great. That's great. Fish throughout our area and water that you could still drink, you know. And what I want to say is where I come from, you can still drink the water from a lake. northern Minnesota, you could still drink the water from a lake. And to me, that's worth everything, you know? So when I think about being great, I think about that, going back a little ways, you know? And that's what we did, you know? But we still got a lot of it. This is our wild rice. I did bring some wild rice because I always get, you know, asked, did you ever bring rice? So we happen to sell pipeline-free wild rice. I just want to let you know. I spent 4 years fighting a corporation called Enbridge with a pipeline proposal they want to throw through our best wild rice beds. 4 years. 4 years. Went to every regulatory hearing. Intervened in every process. Showed up, you know, everywhere. And then in August of this year, after 4 years, the Enbridge company announced that they had canceled the Sandpiper line. And, but then Enbridge went and bought a third of DAPL, Dakota Access Pipeline, or I refer to it as the Dakota Excess Pipeline. You know, and they bought a third of that. And I had a little conversation with Enbridge today. And I said, you know, what Al needs to do is Enbridge needs to say that they're going to withdraw from Dakota Access because they don't like how Energy Transfer is acting, that they don't believe that people should be have dogs put on them and should be locked up, but that they believe there should be a full environmental impact statement. That's what they should do. And that, you know, if there's going to be a pipeline discussion, they should consider another route, which would be just north of Bismarck, which was the original route. But they threw that out so they could put it right by the Indians and not affect the white people, you know. That's what I said to Enbridge. We'll see what they come out with. Okay, so this is our problem. You know, I'm an economist by training, so I spend a lot of time looking at dumb stuff. That's what I feel like, you know. Like what I'm trying to figure out is why would you squander all your natural capital in 50 years and then act like it's going to work out for you? I know y'all follow me on this. Like, that's a really bad idea. That's a really bad idea. You know, to diminish the wealth of the creator in the natural world and think that that's going to work out for you. Like, what planet are you from? You know? So I'm just going to talk about a little bit where we're at, the movement that's there, and, you know, where I'm thinking about it. So just briefly, you know, a few things, but this is where we're at pretty much. I'm 57. You know, you guys, in my 50 years of life, I've had a pretty good time. I've consumed half the world's known fossil fuel resources. Y'all did it with me. Did you have a pretty good time? I mean, just admit it. It's been a blast, right? We got, like, you know, we got, like, flowers from, you know, Colombia the same day. I particularly, sometimes I actually have purchased that Fiji water just because I figure that's got to have the highest carbon footprint in the world. You know what I mean? You understand what I'm saying? It's like, we're, like, this crazy, the stuff that we're flying around, right? We got the, you know, food thing. We've been driving around in these massive automobiles. We've created this society that's like super inefficient, super high consumption. 50 years. That's a lot of fossil fuels, right? So then when you get to that point where you've consumed 50 years and, you know, you've consumed everything that's easy to get and you live in a society that is like super hooked on it, basically, you end up in a situation where you end up like an addict. You know, and that's pretty much what we are. And I don't know, I have an addict, and I have more than one addict in my family. I don't know if anybody has any addicts. My own personal addiction is caffeine. That's my one and only, I just want to say. But, you know, I don't know if any of you have addicts, and addicts are kind of a drag. Do you ever notice that? Like, they do stuff. They, like, do bad stuff. They, like, you know, rationalize, right? They didn't do it. They didn't do it, you know. They lie. Sometimes they steal. They're jerks. They don't get their addiction. And basically, I feel like that's what we've become as a society. You know, I feel like we have an economy that is predicated on an addiction to fossil fuels. And it's not necessary to have an economy that's predicated on an addiction to fossil fuels, but that's what we got. And in that process, when you can't meet your get your fix, you start doing bad stuff, invading countries, you know. And then engaging in what one would call extreme extraction, which is where we're at now. It's extreme behavior. That's what addicts do. So extreme extraction is, you know, blowing off the top of 500 mountains in Appalachia, right? And not even using that coal here anymore. We're closing down coal plants. We're like shipping that stuff over to India, right? That's like crazy stuff, right? Drilling 20,000 feet under the ocean and hoping that that's going to work out, right? My personal feeling is that 20,000 feet under the ocean is where mermaids live. And that's who should be down there. You know what I'm saying? It's like the deep, the dark. We shouldn't be down there. That's not our business, right? I was like, you know, I mean, you know, it doesn't work out. That's why we got the Deepwater Horizon, right? It didn't work out, right? And then you do crazy stuff like this here. That's fracking. That's Texas from the air. That don't look like it's working out too well. The thing about fracking, aside from being extreme and you put 602 chemicals down and then blow up the bedrock of Mother Earth, is that the average, you know, it's the bottom of the barrel when you're fracking, right? It's the bottom of the barrel. And so an average fracking well is about 4 years. And so they have to keep opening up new wells, which is why it's so capital intensive, so expensive, right? You know? And that's why it's super, you know, crazy and aggressive too. This is how far it could go. And then the other thing that you do is the tar sands. So this is what we're looking at. You know, we got a lot of infrastructure for oil companies and new infrastructure coming in for oil companies. And this is what happens with your climate change. So you got bad behavior. You got fossil fuels slathered over everything, pretty much. You know, my personal feeling is that if it says side on it, you shouldn't put it on food. You know, fungicide, herbicide, pesticide, you know, side, last bit, that same thing as homicide, genocide, and suicide, right? I just don't feel like you should put it on food. This is what's happening, you know, unless you've been watching too much Fox News, this is what's going on in the world. Oh, yeah, here it is, the Dakota Access Pipeline thing. But you see, I don't know if y'all understand this, but this is a Bakken well. What I'm trying to point out is that you have high production until year five and then it crashes. You see that? That's what I'm saying. And the reason that this is kind of important in the present national debate that we have on the Dakota Access Pipeline is that right now there's 900,000 barrels a day of oil coming out of North Dakota, the Bakken. 900,000 barrels a day, right? It's like 923,000. But it's busted. It's busted in the Bakken. There's abandoned man camps. You know, it used to be full of drilling rigs, couldn't drive anywhere. Super crazy. Not there. The bomb trains are all split up with other trains. You know what I'm saying? It's not usually full-on bomb trains anymore. Oh, no, you guys still get some full-on bomb trains here? But see, this is all, like, excessive crazy. Like, why do you want to move all that crazy stuff around? You know, that's what my grandfather would say. Why do you want to do that? You know, so there's 900,000 barrels a day right now in the Bakken. And according to Lynn Helms, he's the North Dakota czar of energy. Lynn Helms and North Dakota reports that in 2019, there will be 900,000 barrels a day of oil coming out. So what I'm trying to say is that the 900,000 barrels a day that is coming out of the Bakken is already coming out of the Bakken. It's either in a pipeline or in a train. And pipelines don't replace trains because trains go to different destinations than pipelines, right? They all got it somehow worked out, their customers and their, you know. So to say that if you put in new pipelines, you aren't going to have bomb trains is not true. It's not true at all. It's kind of the Kool-Aid that the oil industry and the politicians want you to drink. So the point is that if there's 900,000 barrels a day that's already going out, and there's 900,000 barrels a day supposed to go out in 2019, what are you going to do with a 570,000 barrel a day pipeline? That's how much that Dakota, that's why I call it the Dakota Access Pipeline. There's not oil to fill that pipeline coming out of North Dakota. Frankly, the only place you could probably fill that pipeline out of is out of the tar sands. So what they just got to do is hook up to Tioga and bring it down. So it's kind of like Keystone Light. That's what you're looking at. And I just want to point out that we did defeat that pipeline, Keystone. And I don't know if y'all noticed this, but they also defeated a big pipeline in Canada this summer. It's called the Northern Gateway pipeline of... In July, the Canadian Appeals Court ruled that the permits were all pulled from the Enbridge company. Pipeline permits all pulled because they did not consult with Native people. You know, my feeling is that this is not 1890. This is not 1920. This is 2016. There are a lot of Native and Indigenous people in the room. And I feel like this is North America. We are not third-class citizens. We are first-class citizens. You got to talk to us. So what I want to say is that, you know, we're facing this social, political crisis of, you know, and an economic crisis. You know, like I said, I'm an economist by training. I did a briefing for the Scandinavian banks yesterday after I walked out of a hearing in Standing Rock. I know you guys are going to go home and you're going to say, man, that woman knows a lot about pipelines. This is not my goal in life. Really. I just kind of want to grow cool corn, ride my horses, write some books. You know what I mean? That's like my plan. But I end up in this pipeline thing. It's like I could win a couple pipeline trivia contests right now. But, you know, come out of that hearing, and I was talking to these banks in Scandinavia, and I said, you know, this is what you call a waste of money. It's called a stranded asset. You're going to put a whole bunch of money into something, and about 5-8 years won't be worth nothing. Waste of money. Waste of money. Like buying a big piece of junk. Shouldn't do it. That's where we're at. In our prophecies as Anishinaabeg people, they talk about the time of the seventh fire. So they call it the time of the seventh fire. And in that time, they say that we as Anishinaabeg people, our prophets told us this a long time ago, we'd have a choice between two paths, they said. And they said one path would be well-worn, but it'd be scorched. They said the other path would not be well-worn, and it would be green. And it would be our choice upon which path to embark, which Mekinah, that's a prophecy they had a long time ago for our people. I'm pretty sure that's where we're all at. We're all at that. Cannot combust ourselves further to oblivion. Cannot make it so that there's no water to drink. You know, cannot poison everything. Got to make a choice. So, you know, as I look at what they are proposing at the Dakota Access Pipeline, the $3.9 billion pipeline that they are spending all that money on, you know, is in the face of a lack of infrastructure, you know, on the Standing Rock Reservation. The road that is blocked, 1806, doesn't even have a shoulder on it. You lose people every year on that road. You know, should have a shoulder on a road in a first world country that's that heavily traveled. Their hospital was built in the 1960s. They have 4 doctors for 8,000 people. Last 2 years ago, a woman named Debbie Dogskin froze to death in her house. Couldn't afford to pay her heating bills. 100 miles from the Bakken. You know what I'm saying? That's America. That's what we're dealing with. That's what we're dealing with. So, you know, we did a little math. Honor the Earth, our organization, I call them our math program. They like doing all the numbers. They're so funny. So for $3.9 billion, instead of buying a pipeline from nowhere, that they're talking about energy self-sufficiency. With $3.9 billion, you could put 5 kilowatts each of solar on 64,629 homes. Not bad, huh? Plus, you could build 323 2-megawatt wind turbines. Not bad, huh? Now I got this 161 retrofits. I think it's 116,100 retrofits, $8,000 each, you know, to make your house a little bit more efficient, right? And so to me, that's this where we're going, where we're at. You know, and in a lot of ways, Standing Rock's story is really America's story because we're a country with a D in infrastructure. And Standing Rock probably has a D minus, F plus, I don't know, you know. You can make some big changes. You know, people say that can't make renewable energy work because we can't meet present demand. I always say, why would you want to? 57% of the power is wasted between point of origin and point of consumption. I want a graceful exit out of the fossil fuel era. I had a blast, but I want a graceful exit. That's what we all want, frankly. And what that looks like is, you know, the combustion engine in the car that brought me here is 16% efficient. Did y'all know that? 16%. So every 6 gallons of gas you put in, only 1 gallon actually moves your vehicle. An electric engine like in a Tesla is 65% efficient. That's the future. You know, what we need to do is to be the people that make those changes. We need to be the people that, you know, are going to be about that future. You know, we got tribal hearings this next week with the federal government on consultation. And I issue a poster and it says, you know, what a great guy. He was also from what's known as North Dakota. His name was Sitting Bull. You know, and what he said is, let us put our minds together to see what kind of future we can make for our children. That's what this time is now.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Who was Charles Darwin, and what led him to describe what we now call the theory of evolution? These curious questions are ones that I have been following since I was about 10 years old. A few years later, in 1978, I had the good fortune of visiting the Galapagos Islands, 600 miles west of Ecuador in the Pacific Ocean. Charles Darwin visited the Galapagos Islands in 1831 for a month as part of his five-year voyage around the world. There, he saw birds and animals that helped him formulate some of his ideas about evolution that he published 22 years later in 1853. And the world has not been the same since. Now, at a time when concepts of evolution and natural selection are attacked from certain theological and political perspectives, a novel called The Darwin Conspiracy has been written by John Darton, a writer and editor for the New York Times. The Darwin Conspiracy, although fiction, is said by John Darton to be 90% accurate and covers Charles Darwin's life and thinking that led to the publication of Darwin's book, The Origin of the Species, as well as a portion of Darwin's life after the publication of his book. I spoke with John Darton from his home in New York City at the end of October 2005. He begins by describing who Charles Darwin was in his time and in his place. John Darton, welcome to Radio Curious.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here, Barry.
Let's put Charles Darwin in perspective. Who was he in his period in his life, living in England?
Well, he was really one of the great scientists of all time. In fact, though, he was an amateur. He was an amateur naturalist. His father very much wanted him to be a doctor. He could not stand basically the sight of blood, so he washed out as a doctor. And throughout his growing up years, he was just attracted to the natural world. He loved to go looking for beetles and to perform various experiments, and he did that throughout his years at Cambridge. Then, just fortuitously, he got this invitation to travel on the Beagle. He leapt at it. He had some trouble, actually, getting it because his father initially opposed the trip. And then he went on this glorious five-year trip around the world, despite the fact that he was badly seasick every day on the high seas. It opened up his eyes to the world of nature in a way that I guess he could just not have anticipated. And it pushed him to start thinking. And once Darwin started thinking, he thought deeply and deeply, more deeply, and never stopped thinking. And the questions that confronted him were the questions of the age, which was, you know, is evolution a fact, and how could it have happened? He became, I guess, obsessed with this, and as we all know, came up with a resolution. What interests me in him is he's perfect specimen of his age. That is to say, he was a Victorian. He assumed the hierarchy of Victorian values were the true ones, that is, Europeans were at the top of the totem pole, and yet his scientific nature took over so that he saw a kind of equality among the species. We're on the same level as earthworms in his scheme of things.
How do you see that change in his thinking? What brought it about?
Certainly one moment of epiphany had to be when on the Beagle, which don't forget had three so-called savages, what the Victorians called savages on board, who had been picked up by the captain, Robert Fitzroy, in a previous trip, brought to England, dressed up and civilized, and then were being thrown back into their natural habitat. Anyway, when the Beagle arrived at Tierra del Fuego, at the very tip of South America, he saw the Indians, and they were so primitive that they just formed this indelible impression on him. He described seeing them running along the banks, kind of foaming at the mouth, and some of them bleeding and huffing and puffing, and dressed just in the most kind of primitive loincloths made out of animal skins. And he was frankly shocked at what he saw in terms of humans. So I think that actually, in some level, maybe made it easier for him to see humans kind of evolving out of a lesser species, because he certainly thought these were lesser people. And then, of course, when he went to the Galapagos, he saw and was confronted with the notion that on different islands, animals like turtles had distinguishing characteristics, which must at some point have led him to believe, to the realization that if you have geographic isolation, species could actually evolve somewhat differently. That would be a key point in his thinking.
And that's something that is generally acknowledged now, particularly as it's shown in the Galapagos Islands, which make up about a dozen or so islands right on the equator, 600 miles west of Ecuador.
Right, right, exactly. But, you know, while he was there, he, of course, he kept extensive journals, and he wrote one or two interesting, intriguing little passages. He said something to the equivalent of, you know, you almost get a sense of the origin of life here. But it is clear he did not yet have the theory. It didn't come to him. In fact, he made a major blunder while he was in the Galapagos when he was collecting finches. He did not mark them separately by location. So he didn't know which island they had come from. He put them all together in one bag, and it would have really simplified his deductions later if he had kept them, the various specimens, isolated. So we know that he did not actually, the theory kind of came to him in bits and pieces over the years after he got back to England. It wasn't like a lightning bolt that suddenly struck him overnight.
It was about 22 years after he visited the Galapagos Islands before he wrote his or published his theory.
Yes, exactly. That's really one of the elements that prompted me to write an historical novel about him. There are three things that intrigued me. One, it did take him 22 years. He was like a world-class procrastinator, and he only did it after he got this letter out of the blue from a competitor, Alfred Russel Wallace, who came up with the exact same theory and wanted help in getting it published. That's what prompted Darwin to finally sit down and write. So he was delaying all this time, you know, spending 8 years studying barnacles and that kind of thing. And then there were two other things. He was a world-class hypochondriac after he got back to England. He suffered from unbelievable maladies, and the symptoms are so varied that no single illness can explain them. And thirdly, he really never traveled again. You know, this adventurer who at the age of 22 went around the world came back to England and basically never left England again. He took one trip to Wales. And so, you know, what could explain this kind of interesting array of eccentricities?
Well, looking at the theory of evolution, as he expressed it in The Origin of the Species, you speak of Alfred R. Wallace also having a similar theory, mm-hmm. with the concept that the wheel was invented in several places at more or less the same time. Do you know where Wallace got his theory, how it came in?
I know the lore of it, which seems to be the truth. Wallace, like Darwin, was influenced by Malthus's theory, which is, you know, that the human population would be exploding in numbers and out of control were it not for famine and war and poverty that kept down the numbers. They both had read this book and were influenced by that train of thinking. Secondly, and this was sort of surprising to me, the theory of evolution was very much in the air and had been before Darwin himself was even born. His grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, believed in evolution. That is to say, He believed that one species grew out of another, that it would, I guess you look at humans, you look at chimps, you realize there are similarities, and so it's natural to assume maybe there was a common ancestor. But what Darwin did was to come up with a mechanism that could explain how it could happen, that is natural selection. That was his great advance. And Wallace came up with the exact same idea in a bout of malarial fever. He was on the other side of the world in the Moluccas, doing some research, came down with malaria, was apparently lying in a thatched hut, and the theory just came to him like that, like a bolt out of the blue.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with John Darton from his home in New York City about his book, The Darwin Conspiracy, which I understand, John, is about 90% accurate and about 10% fiction.
I like to say that. That is to say, all the historical characters actually existed and for the most part did the actions they're shown as doing. But I took significant liberties in two areas. The book is really told on three different time levels. The modern day, where there's a young researcher looking into Darwin. Then in the 1860s, when Darwin is already an old man, he's already published Origin of the Species. He's at his country estate called Downhouse. And then an earlier period when Darwin was on the Beagle. So I examine Darwin as an old man through the eyes of his daughter, one of his daughters named Lizzie. And she keeps a journal. And in the journal, she records her growing suspicions about her father based on all these eccentricities that she's observing. Well, I made up the journal, and in large part I made up Lizzie's character because she's not really well known to us. She's a kind of blank canvas, so I use that canvas to paint a portrait. And finally, I kind of changed an important fact on the Beagle itself. There was a member there of the crew named Robert McCormick, the ship's surgeon, and I make him... He was indeed very jealous of Darwin. He became a rival because he thought he should be the one to send back specimens to London. And I change his narrative. And I do all that. It's not an historical novel in that way. It's an ahistorical novel. I violate some of the precepts by actually changing facts around. And I do it, you know, for a higher good, I think.
You also talk about Charles Darwin having a secret life.
Up to a point, without destroying the suspense of the book, Darwin, we know he was plagued by illness, by procrastination, by his kind of phobia about appearing in public to defend his theory. And so I resolve all these various interesting threads in his personality by saying he feels guilty. He feels guilty for something. What is it that he could possibly feel guilty about? Well, an event happened during his five-year trip on the Beagle, a seminal event that accounts for where he actually got the theory, how the theory came to him, and why he should feel guilty about it, because, in effect, he expropriated it from the most unlikely quarter of all. That's, I can't quite say, but... But the intent here, the real intent, is to kind of divorce Darwinism from Darwin the man. So I've changed Darwin's character. I made him darker than he really was, in all likelihood. I made him possessed by guilt, with a sense almost of original sin. And by divorcing Darwinism from Darwin, I want to really emphasize the simplicity and elegance of his theory, and to highlight, you know, the absurdity of creationism and its modern evil twin, intelligent design. So I do that. I change the narrative for an ulterior motive of actually dealing with Darwin's theory as much as with Darwin himself.
John Darton, I want you to explain the simplicity of Darwin's theory, but first I want to say that this is Radio Curious, and we're talking in this edition with John Darton, the author of The Darwin Conspiracy, a novel about the life of Charles Darwin. I'm Barry Vogel. John Darton, can you give us the Darwin theory that you describe as very simple?
I mean, basically, it is that creatures pass on characteristics to their offspring, which we all know. Occasionally, there are mutations. If these mutations are helpful or advantageous to survival, then those offspring will have a better chance of survival. If the mutations are negative, are harmful to the chances for survival, those offspring will die out. So that over time, over a long, long period of time, species will gradually evolve and change. And then if they're separated by, say, rivers or mountains or oceans, species that began, that were once one species, might even develop differently into different species. I mean, that's the theory in a nutshell. It's, when I say it's simple, I don't mean simple-minded. I mean it's elegant because it explains everything. So much so that Thomas Huxley, who was Darwin's great advocate and described himself as Darwin's bulldog, when he heard of the theory, he is said to have remarked, "How stupid of me not to have thought of it," because it's one of those great qualitative leaps ahead in which suddenly the world becomes understandable if you apply this basic theory of natural selection. He did not, of course, Darwin himself did not call it a theory of evolution. That word wasn't in common usage in its current sense back then. He called it theory of natural selection. And the famous slogan, survival of the fittest, was not his invention. It came from Herbert Spencer at the time. And Darwin was persuaded to use that instead of natural selection, to use the phrase survival of the fittest by Wallace, because it made it clear that it was a kind of random process. If you say natural selection, Darwin realized, well, you might imply there's a kind of entity out there that's doing the selecting. But if you say survival of the fittest, then you're shifting the emphasis, and you make it clear that it's really this sort of impersonal force that's acting, a selective force. There's not something doing the selecting. Darwin, you know, he did become progressively an atheist as he aged.
The view that can be seen on the Galapagos Islands now, which is the same as what Darwin saw about 175 years ago, basically the length of two human lives, is in the finches looking at the different islands and the different shapes, primarily of the beaks of the finches, which evolved to adapt to the food that was available.
Well, yeah, I understand, Barry, you were there. So
that's right.
You see, as soon as you arrive, you're struck by it. It's kind of like walking through a door to a different world, because all of the animals and birds act differently. They're not frightened of humans. They've never been hunted, and so they kind of exist, and you get this sense you're in primordial nature. And the beaks of the finches are actually very important in the scheme of things, because there has been a study beginning with two professors at Princeton, the Grants, in which they went to one island there and studied finches over years and years and years, recording various characteristics, including the size and shape of the beaks. And they were able to establish that when, for example, there is plentiful rainfall, the beaks in the ensuing generations are actually somewhat different. That is to say, They may be like a broader, like a kind of pair of pliers, or narrower, like a pair of kind of thin pliers to get at the seeds. And in times of drought, they have to be broader so they can crack a shell around a certain type of seed, and those are the birds that survive. When there's plentiful rain, they actually find nourishment more easily in a kind of little seed that can be extracted with the long, thin kind of wire head, pincer-type beaks. So they can actually see evolution unfolding in direct response to the climactic conditions. It's a famous experiment, and I drew upon that kind of shamelessly. A book called Beak of the Finch, a Pulitzer Prize-winning book, for the opening chapter of my novel, where the main character, Hugh, is involved in this study, and he's all alone on an island. So that kind of ties it together.
Well, John Darton, I want to ask about you. You're the son of a former New York Times reporter. You are a New York Times reporter and editor. You've lived in Lagos, Nairobi, Warsaw, Madrid, London, now New York City. How do you see being an editor when you editorialize in the things that you choose to write about, as I do, on selecting guests here for Radio Curious? What points do you seek to make when you editorialize by producing a work such as you have in The Darwin Conspiracy?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because I've drawn a real distinction in my working life between fact and fiction. For 39 years, I've worked for the New York Times, beginning as a copy boy, then a local reporter, then a foreign correspondent, and then stints as an editor, both, you know, metro editor and news editor and culture editor. All that time, I was dedicated to, you know, I mean, I don't, it sounds corny, but a kind of search for truth. I mean, nothing but the facts. And I don't believe in a higher truth or a lower truth, just kind of the truth. And the more you deviate from the facts at hand, the more you deviate from the truth. That's on the one hand. Then I had a kind of a doctor, you know, that was my Dr. Jekyll. And then the Mr. Hyde in me, working at night and on weekends, would write fiction. And there I just let my imagination go. And it's fun to be to work in the exact opposite vein, that is to say, make up quotes, not looking back through your notebook carefully to make sure every word of the quote is accurate, and to just deal with themes that you can't otherwise deal with in daily journalism. So I keep that border between fact and fiction very, very secure. And someone, a writer called Stacey Schiff, wrote a piece last year saying the longest unprotected border in the world is not between Canada and the United States. It's between fact and fiction. And I believe that. We have to keep that border in mind so that we don't have these, you know, smugglers and traffickers crossing back and forth, reporters making up things and putting them in the newspaper, things like that, which, of course, destroy journalism very quickly.
When you go into the area of fiction and meld it with the facts as you have in The Darwin Conspiracy, it allows you to purvey or deliver an underlying message or theme.
Yes, exactly right. I mean, that's exactly the point of fiction. You know, it can start with an essential lie. And that's what transforms it from otherwise what might be just kind of journalism. In the case of the Darwin Conspiracy, you know, I was struck by the fact that in his day, Darwin confronted the same arguments that we're now hearing again today against evolution. And back then, there was an argument for so-called intelligent design. The same way there is today. Back then, the metaphor that was used was a watch. And there was a book by a man called Paley called Natural Theology, in which he advanced the argument as follows. If you're walking across a field and you come upon a watch, you pick it up, its beauty and its kind of the elegance of its functioning must make you think there is a watchmaker. That was the total argument for the existence of God. And the same argument is used today, of course, by proponents of intelligent design. In fact, that's the entire argument. You know, they changed the metaphor. If you came upon Mount Rushmore today and saw human figures carved in stone in an immense scale, you must assume there is a sculptor. So Darwin confronted these very same arguments. And what I've done in this case is to recreate, redo the narrative of his life to kind of emphasize the truth of his theory. You know, because I do believe his theory is true, as do, you know, most scientists who work with in the fields of biology and medicine and evolution.
And as you mentioned, you see this as a direct challenge to the concept of intelligent design.
I do. I mean, in a nutshell, there's a climactic scene in which there's an exchange of views between the civilized Englishman and an Indian tribe led by the shaman. And not to put too fine a point on it, but the lesson there is which side does the creation myth lie on? And if you just are a true observer of how nature functions, untrammeled by all the kind of baggage of Western thinking, you might come out with a very different conclusion.
John Darton, author of The Darwin Conspiracy, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Yes, I've been on a book tour, and a book tour means there are a certain number of nights in hotels in which you have nothing to do but see the town or read. So I picked up two books, and the one that I would recommend is a book by Orhem Pamuk, a Turkish writer called Snow. It's a novel, and I think it's absolutely wonderful. He uses new techniques of narration to draw you into the world, and you begin to understand the whole world of Islamic fundamentalism and kind of modern Turkey and the secularist kind of drive in Turkey and its pull between Western Europe and ancient Islam. And it's beautifully written with very strong characters. That was the book that stood out for me recently.
John Darton, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you, Barry. I enjoyed it.
John Darton is the author of The Darwin Conspiracy. The book he recommends is Snow by Orhem Pamuk.